hoteles, tiendas, comercios, etcétera, pues es tremendamente importante el saber tratar bien y con la atención debida a estos turistas, que por otro lado, pues según todas las estadísticas que tenemos, empresas como Visa, por ejemplo, pues tiene una media de gasto muy superior a cualquier otro turista de otros países. Con lo cual, creo que es imprescindible que, como digo, pues sepamos bien conocer cuál es su protocolo, cuáles son sus hábitos, y para ello, pues hoy contamos con la inestimable colaboración de dos excelentes profesores, el señor Kevin Latham, a quien agradecemos muchísimo que haya venido para esta ocasión de Londres. El profesor Latham es profesor de SOAS, de la School of Oriental and Asian Studies. Es probablemente pues la entidad universitaria más importante desde hace ya muchísimos años y de referencia, por supuesto, en todo lo que son estudios asiáticos. Y además pues ha escrito un libro que tengo constancia de que ha sido pues un auténtico bestseller sobre el turismo emisor hacia Europa. Con lo cual, pues creo que nos puede dar una visión de primera mano. Además, pues habla perfectamente chino, y por lo tanto creo que nos puede dar una visión perfectamente, pues como digo, cualificada de lo que es el turismo emisor chino, de cuáles son sus hábitos y sus costumbres en Europa. Y también tenemos a una colaboradora habitual de la casa, a la profesora Yuen Gao, que ha estado colaborando muchísimo con nosotros en toda una serie de cursos de protocolo, también en el puerto de Barcelona, y que estoy seguro de que también pues nos va a dar, como digo, pues una visión complementaria y a la vez necesaria para que pues en su conjunto podamos entender bien todo el fenómeno, tanto desde un punto de vista teórico de lo que es el turismo emisor chino, como desde un punto de vista pues tremendamente práctico, como digo, del receptivo aquí, o sea, de qué es lo que hay que hacer realmente para fidelizar al cliente, que al final yo creo que es lo que nos interesa a todos. Decirles pues que este programa no hubiera sido posible sin la colaboración del Instituto Confucio, y por lo tanto pues quiero agradecer muchísimo al profesor Chang, el director del Instituto Confucio en Barcelona, todo el apoyo que presta a Casa Asia. Creo que la labor que está haciendo el Instituto es impagable, es impagable, tanto por lo que respecta a la enseñanza del chino como por lo que respecta pues a la promoción cultural de China. Por lo tanto, pues este programa es una colaboración entre el Instituto y Casa Asia. Pues a continuación, por supuesto, pues me gustaría cederle la palabra al profesor Chang para que nos dé un saludo de bienvenida. Muchas gracias.
Muchas gracias, Amadeu. La verdad, muchas gracias por Casa Asia, las amables palabras de Amadeu. Confucio de Barcelona tiene 4 años de vida, está funcionando muy bien. Empezamos con 6 alumnos, tenemos en este momento 1.200 alumnos con 22 profesores. Este año vamos a ir al Congreso Mundial de los Institutos Confucio en China. A nivel mundial, 460 confucios, y somos uno de ellos. En España hay 6. Barcelona tiene 4 años, pero somos el que más rápidamente ha crecido y el que de una forma más sana, más estable, más, digamos, sostenible, se ha desarrollado. Yo tengo la última noticia de que en diciembre, en el congreso próximo, el 9º Congreso Mundial de Instituto Confucio, nos van a dar la denominación de Instituto Confucio de Excelencia Mundial. Estamos trabajando muchísimo, pero muchísimo, y muy a grado con Casa Asia, porque Casa Asia es fundadora, una de las tres fundadoras locales, la Autónoma de Barcelona, la Universidad de Barcelona y Casa Asia. Junto con una universidad que han fundado la Fundación Instituto Confucio de Barcelona, como ven ustedes que estamos haciendo cosas entre las cuales estamos orgullosos de poder hacer cosas con Casa Asia, que tiene un equipo extraordinariamente profesional, de alta calidad humana, de gran eficiencia en el trabajo. La verdad que estamos muy a gusto de hacer cosas con Casa Asia. Tema conferencia, tema curso de protocolo y cualquier cosa. A veces hacemos una gran cosa con Gael y con toda Casa Asia. Este año, el 1 de febrero de este año, hicimos una cosa sin precedentes en Barcelona, que es el desfile en la cabalgata china, con dragones, leones en la calle. Pero les vamos a decir que en el próximo año en febrero estamos preparando hacer algo similar, pero mucho más colorido, mucho más grande y mucho más bonito, con el apoyo decidido del Ayuntamiento y de la Generalitat, también del Consulado. Los organizadores principales somos Casa Asia y Confucio. Desde luego, repetir que Confucio, agradecido y con mucho placer, la verdad, encantado de colaborar con el personal de Casa Asia, con Amadeu, con Gael y con todos. Encantado y un placer, y muchas gracias por su atención.
Muy bien, muchísimas gracias, profesor. And now, Professor Latham, the floor is yours. So.
Thank you, first of all, to everyone that's invited me here today and done everything to facilitate a very smooth arrival. I've seen that things are working very well. Thank you for the very flattering introduction. It's on. Hello, can you hear me? Okay, I was saying thank you to everyone who's invited me here and made it possible for me to be here. I'm honoured to come here and talk to you today. I hope that something that I'm going to say will be both interesting and hopefully of practical use as well. I'm going to talk to you about Chinese outbound tourism, as you know, and particularly focusing on Europe and, as far as I can, Spain. However, I should say that I'm a China expert. I'm not a Spanish expert by any means. So the talk is informed by my experience and research more in other parts of Europe, and dealing with China and Chinese people in general for the last 25 years, rather than a particular experience of Spain. So I'm sure that a lot of people here will have more specific knowledge about what's going on in Spain. But nonetheless, I think there are plenty of things that we can learn from other European experiences, and that will be part of the aim of today. Okay. The presentation, I'm going to be taking the first two sessions. So the first session will be about Chinese outbound tourism in perspective. I hope to give an overview of how the Chinese outbound tourism market is developing, and particularly how it relates to Europe. Then thinking about different European destinations in comparative perspective, looking at the different issues that face different countries, and trying to think about how Spain is situated compared to other leading destinations for Chinese tourism in Europe. And then starting to think about who the Chinese tourists are. What are they doing? What's their behavior as tourists in Europe and elsewhere? And that will lead into the second session after a break, and we'll have Q&A. I hope to try and keep the talk down to around 50 minutes, and then we have 10 minutes for questions. Before starting the second session, where I will go into a little bit more detail about the cultural and social background of Chinese outbound tourists, thinking also about cultural and linguistic considerations for those who are trying to deal with Chinese tourists, and then thinking briefly about what this might mean for trying to adapt your offer, your services, and preparing for Chinese tourists in the future. So if we go ahead with session one. First of all, it's worth noting that travel, even within China up until the 1980s, was very limited. So tourism in general, let alone outbound tourism, foreign tourism, is a relatively new phenomenon in China. Before the 1980s, all travel in China was linked to official party work, basically. But with economic reform starting in 1978, and I'll say a bit more about that in the second session, so I won't say too much now, basically China opened up to foreigners and to inbound tourism, first of all, leading up to the possibility of outbound tourism in the 1990s. Outbound tourism then was at fairly low levels, and the real growth, certainly as far as Europe is concerned, has happened more in the 2000s. And in fact, if you look at the next slide, you can see here how growth has developed from the late 1990s up until 2013, and with projections there for 2014-15. Basically, you have annual growth rates of between 15% and 20%, and now we are up to around 100 million Chinese tourists going overseas for their holiday, although we're going to qualify a little bit about what we mean by overseas in a moment. Here's that in numbers. COT, incidentally, is Chinese Outbound Travel and Tourism. It saves writing it out each time. In 2013, we were up to nearly 100 million Chinese. And the striking figure, which is the one that perhaps gets people like yourselves and others around the world interested, is the amount of expenditure that's going into this sector. $102 billion is an awful lot of money. And we'll talk a bit more about expenditure later on and how much people are spending and what they're spending it on to some degree as well. And you can see I've got the figures there for first quarter in 2014. That was the latest, the most recent figures that I could get hold of. But basically you can see the same level of increase is continuing. It's about, works out about 16-17% increase on the previous year. Now, I said that 100 million outbound tourists needs to be qualified a little bit. The majority of these are going to Hong Kong, Macau, and Taiwan. Okay. So perhaps to some of our thinking, they're not really outbound tourists because this is Greater China. But they are counted as outbound tourists. So that 100 million, 70 million are going to Greater China destinations. And of the rest, around 12% come to Europe. Okay. So you can see at the bottom of the page there, in 2013, we're talking about 3.5 million Chinese tourists coming to Europe last year, and that is obviously increasing in proportion to outbound tourism as a whole. Other popular destinations I've listed there, but it's perhaps easier to look at this chart, where you can see the big red section is all of those going to Hong Kong, Macau, and Taiwan. And the second largest section is also Asia, okay? Understandably, we're talking about places that are nearer, cheaper, and of greater cultural affinity. There are large Chinese populations, sort of indigenous Chinese populations, if you can say that, in Southeast Asia, Peranakan Chinese, for instance, in Indonesia, Malaysia, who have been there for generations, but nonetheless maintain their Chinese identity. There are similarities in food, ability to speak Chinese, etc. So it's much easier for Chinese tourists in those destinations. And, of course, it's cheaper, and we'll talk a bit about that later on. But also, you can see in the remainder, in the section of the rest of the world, nonetheless, Europe holds out quite well. It's the largest section there. Of course, we have to split Europe up into 20-odd other destinations, and that pie gets sliced even finer. But nonetheless, there's an interrelationship between the countries within Europe for Chinese tourism. So a lot of tourists are not just coming to one country. If they go to France, then they may well come to Spain. Okay. So if they come to Germany, they're likely to go to Holland and Luxembourg and Belgium and France. In some senses, it doesn't make a lot of sense to split up the European countries and say if they're going to one country, they're not going to another. And I'll talk a bit more about that later on as well. What we might ask is driving this growth in outbound tourism. I should have put these in a slightly different order. The first thing we should mention is the increasing wealth of the Chinese middle classes. Okay. As the economy develops, I'm going to talk more about this in the second session this morning, so I'll talk a little bit more about the middle classes so you understand where they're coming from. But the growth in the Chinese economy has produced an increasingly large middle class and also wealthier affluent and super affluent classes. And they have greater disposable income and they like increasingly to travel. Okay, so that's the broader perspective, the main driving factor for outbound tourism. However, there are also more particular short-term and middle-term effects produced by the strength of the renminbi, the Chinese currency, which currently is quite strong, and therefore is making travel cheaper for Chinese tourists, relatively. And of course, a lot of the shopping that they do, they already find that luxury goods that they find in Europe cost much less because of lower taxes, etc., than they do in China. So buying your Gucci bag or your Louis Vuitton cases or your Piaget watches or whatever it may be, even if they may seem expensive to the likes of you and me, well, certainly me, they seem cheap to certain Chinese tourists. And the strength of the renminbi only helps that further. Okay. Other factors that have helped as far as many countries are concerned, including Europe, the easing of procedures for travel documents in China, but also the relaxation of visa regulations. A lot of countries have seen this as a way of trying to attract and compete with other tourist destinations around the world, because Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the US have all eased or made efforts to try and ease the procedures for getting tourist visas, and Europe is, of course, in many ways following suit as well. And that's an important issue which is shown by the experience of the UK, which I'll mention a little bit later on. Another factor there, increasing numbers of Chinese students, overseas students coming to Europe. I don't know how many you have here in Spain, perhaps fewer, certainly fewer than we have in the UK, but they are important for the tourist industries for various reasons. One is that they themselves like to travel. If you're here studying for a year, 2 years, 3 years, or even if it's just 6 months, it may be one of the few opportunities you have to subsidize your holiday in Europe, and they like to take the advantage of the opportunity to travel to other European countries while they're here. So even if they're studying in the UK or Germany and so on, of course we now have cheap air travel with the likes of Ryanair and EasyJet and so on, and it's easy to get around Europe, and they take advantage of that. And another factor is, of course, that they have visiting relatives. They have their parents come, their cousins, their school friends, etc., take advantage of having a contact in Europe also to come and stay and travel around. So increasing student numbers is actually an important factor while we're talking about the numbers at the level that they are at the moment. I've also put their capitalization of large Chinese tour operators. Basically, the Chinese tourist industry is developing, it's corporatizing, it's becoming more professional, more efficient, it's you having more efficient publicity and advertising and marketing, etc., so that all drives great growth in the sector. Okay, so let's think a little bit briefly about some different European destinations. The most visited destinations in Europe are, I should say actually as a caveat, this is based on statistics which are to some degree dubious or statistics are difficult things to work with. They give you an indication, but they're never entirely accurate. And one of the problems with statistics on tourism is that everybody counts a tourist in a different way. Some people might be counting the number of visas issued. Others may be counting the number of arrivals at airports. Others may be including also land and sea arrivals. Others may be looking at how many people leave the country, etc. So there are lots of different ways of counting tourists, which all lead to different numbers and statistics, which makes things complicated. But nonetheless, we can fairly definitively say that France, Germany, Italy are amongst the top destinations. Switzerland has been growing quite rapidly in the last couple of two or three years. Austria is another popular destination, Vienna in particular. The UK is also popular, but I'll say a bit more about that later on, because of UK euro scepticism and the fact that we haven't entered the Schengen Treaty, then we have far fewer than we would potentially have in terms of Chinese tourists. I'll talk a bit more about that later on. There is competition between European tourist destinations, but at the same time, as I was saying, there is an interdependence that the fact that, as we'll say later on, that tourists go to several countries, they rarely come to just one European country. So if they're arriving in France, that's good for the neighbouring countries. If they're arriving in Germany, similarly. Okay. So there is an interdependence and potentially mutual support that you could have between European tourist destinations. Spain, as far as I can gather, ranks about 9th or 10th. This is based on figures that are 2 or 3 years old now, so it may have changed, I don't know. But Spain is somewhere within the bottom end of the top 10, more or less, which is perhaps lower than it ought to be, given the nature of the history of the country and the cultural opportunities that it has on offer. And the tourist industry, which is, of course, very well developed here for tourists from other originating countries. Before we look at a few profiles of different countries and what affects them, let's think briefly about the broad issues that affect the popularity of a tourist destination from a Chinese point of view. The first is, it was not necessarily in any particular order, but the first I've got here is location, and that is very important. Where you land, how the proximity to other European countries is very important, because if you land in Germany, it's easy to get to 5, 6, 7 neighbouring European countries very easily. We'll say, when it comes to talk about Spain a little bit later on, that's one of the challenges that you have here that you can't really do much about in some way. You can't move Spain to another part of Europe. Fame and history is, of course, also important. If the country is famous for whether it's something positive or negative, like colonialism, or key roles in history, economics, etc. I'll give some examples in a moment. Accessibility is linked to the location. Links to China, that could be historical links, economic links, trade links, cultural links, or personal links. Large Chinese populations, etc., and Spain has quite a large Chinese population, larger than some other European countries, so that may be to your advantage, of course. And geography. One of the key reasons that Chinese tourists give for coming to Europe, what they expect of Europe, is beautiful scenery, okay, amongst other things, but sightseeing and beautiful scenery is one of those. And so if you have great geography, which again I think you could say that Spain certainly has, there may be potential there for selling it, but it has to become recognized. That's the thing. Let's look at a few countries from a Chinese perspective. This is not saying how I would compare these countries, but it's trying to look at it from the point of view of Chinese tourism. Okay, France, as I said, one of the most desirable European destinations, has a good central location. It has good air and land connectivity. There are lots of flights directly from Paris to Beijing, Shanghai, Hong Kong, etc., as well as indirect flights. So it's well positioned. If you land in Paris, you can easily get to Belgium, Holland, Luxembourg, Germany, down into Italy, and across into Spain if you want to as well. It, of course, has iconic symbols like the Eiffel Tower, which are almost symbolic not just of France but of Europe from a Chinese perspective. Very often, if you look at a Chinese website and they want to give an image of Europe, it might well be the Eiffel Tower. It could be Tower Bridge in London or something as well. But it has symbolic tourist venues that supersede France, if you like. They go beyond the boundaries of France. And, of course, it has recognized historical figures ranging from Napoleon, who's a well-known historical figure in China who people would study about, and in terms of artistic production, French Impressionism, Monet, etc., etc. There's obviously a great cultural history that they can tap into, as well as France being also an important colonial power in Southeast Asia, where links with China are not very distant. Key role in the global fashion industry. I was talking a bit about luxury fashion items just now. You have Yves Saint Laurent, Louis Vuitton, and so on. The big French fashion brands, which the Chinese often go crazy for if they've got the money for it. So it's the idea of buying your Louis Vuitton in France has a certain chicness about it, I suppose, as well as being cheap and finding that the shop assistants speak Chinese and that kind of thing as well. There are links to China, which are particular. Both Zhou Enlai and Deng Xiaoping, who are two you probably know, two very important Chinese leaders from the past, Zhou Enlai being the second man to Mao Zedong, and Deng Xiaoping, of course, starting the reform period after Mao died. Both worked in a Renault factory making French cars in the 1920s or somewhere early in the 20th century, I forget exactly when. And so the little town where they lived becomes a destination because every Chinese school kid has learnt that Deng Xiaoping studied in this French town and so on. So it becomes somewhere to visit. So particular things like that can affect a country's popularity with Chinese tourists or give them another destination to visit, shall we say. The French government has also done a lot to attract Chinese tourists, promote cultural exchanges and links with the Chinese government, as well as, of course, trade and commercial interests. An interesting thing to note that in France, a lot of the tourism has been concentrated around Paris and the Île-de-France, and regional authorities that have tried to, in the past to attract Chinese out of that Parisian circle have met with only limited success. So it's not always a matter of, it's not always easy to pull people away from well-known tourist centres. Okay, let's quickly go through some other countries. Germany, by contrast, of course, has a key place in European and world history, ranging from the positive and in the global economy to the negative with the Second World War and Adolf Hitler and so on and so forth. But it's all things that are known by Chinese people. It's part of common Chinese knowledge, things that you would associate with Germany. Again, you've got central location. In fact, Germany is possibly has the most people landing by air in of any European country from China because of that connectivity that I've been mentioning. I won't labour the point too far. And, of course, it also has good shopping opportunities which are linked to those airports, okay? So it has recognised historical intellectual figures I've got there, ranging from, again, Adolf Hitler, but also, of course, Karl Marx was German, so therefore there's a particular importance of the links to China as well. The UK is in many ways missing the opportunity of Chinese travellers and is therefore a contrasting destination in some ways. Surveys of Chinese potential tourists suggest that the UK would be up there with France, if not even higher than France, for a desirable destination. But it actually currently receives about a quarter to a third of the number of Chinese tourists that France does. And that's because of the problems with visa arrangements, because the UK is not part of the Schengen agreement. You have to apply for a separate visa, which means extra expense, it means extra bureaucracy, it means waiting longer, etc., etc. The British government has been under some pressure by the tourist industries in recent years to do something about that, to try to relax visa arrangements, and has made some, I would say, slightly reluctant moves in that direction. Particularly, as you will understand probably, that the political climate in the UK at the moment is moving in many ways in a Eurosceptic direction, so, and also anti-immigration direction. So tourists opening up to Chinese tourists opens up all these rather bigoted, racist kind of ideas. However, beyond that, the UK is almost the perfect destination. It has the iconic landmarks that everybody knows about, Buckingham Palace, Tower Bridge, etc., etc., okay? It has fantastic, London and many other parts of the UK have fantastic museums which are often free. There are iconic shopping locations, Harrods, Harvey Nichols, etc., etc. So all of those things contribute to, if the UK were to enter the Schengen arrangement, then I think you would find that the UK would go shooting up for those reasons in the number of tourists that arrive. Switzerland is perhaps a slightly different example. So I'm trying to pick contrasting cases here. They've seen strong recent growth in Chinese tourist numbers, which is in no small part due to a growing interest in the ski industry, that there are ski resorts, especially for the wealthier Chinese tourists, which have become attractive. You find that certainly two or three of the top ski resorts have started to employ Chinese-speaking ski instructors in order to cater to Chinese tourists and so on. Switzerland is famous for its watches, and watches are amongst the most popular items for luxury gifts and purchases. This has perhaps been affected in recent years by the clampdown on corruption, because watches were a way of laundering corrupt money in China, but also have become a very visible sign of your perhaps wealth that doesn't match your income, so to speak. So watches have perhaps are less important than they used to be, but nonetheless, for wealthy business people and so on, there's no problem with spending your money on whatever you want to spend it on. And holidays in high class holidays in Switzerland are increasingly popular. The Swiss tourism business has made some quite important steps towards trying to cater to that Chinese desire, but it is rather patchy. It's in certain places, certain resorts where there are more Chinese coming, and other destinations, if a Chinese decides to visit a different ski resort to do something different, they may find that actually, well, suddenly they haven't got the Chinese-speaking instructor, there aren't any tour guides in Chinese, etc., etc. So it is a patchy operation. Italy is, in my opinion, a good example, perhaps, of somewhere which is spoilt. Okay, it's It has too much, and people are, this is with all due respect to Sergio here, it has too much going for it. It has a fantastic artistic and cultural history, which is very well recognized in all the art history books throughout the world, including those in China. Everyone in China has, of course, heard about the Roman Empire, so you have the history and the archaeology, the attraction of Rome, the Colosseum, etc., etc., etc. It's also fairly well situated. It's not difficult to get to from Germany or France, Austria, and so on. So it's a little bit peripheral, a bit like Spain because it's a peninsula, but it's got perhaps better connections at the top. This is obviously very positive for Italy, but you might say that it's also a negative in that Italians perhaps take it for granted that tourists will come to Italy anyway, and whether they're Chinese or anyone, and so therefore they don't really need to adapt. I mean, I could tell you all sorts of stories about Italy, but like the fact that you can't use credit cards at a national museum in Rome about 200 metres from the Vatican is like, anyway. So there's all sorts of things going on. They're not very good dealing with any tourists in some ways, but they all keep coming in millions and millions. And so Italy is, in my opinion, a little bit spoiled. They have made some efforts to try and ease visa application procedures, but these are perhaps less than some other European countries have done. But it's an interesting example of somewhere which has a sort of inherent attraction and a reputation as a tourist destination, which draws people, and so therefore maybe they don't make so much effort as they need to. So let's try and think a little bit about Spain, okay? Thinking about Spain, if you look at some surveys that have been done of what Spain is recognized for amongst Chinese people, okay? This is not my representation of Spain, okay? So don't get angry. This is, it's well recognized for bullfighting, art and architecture to some degree, especially, of course, Picasso is perhaps the most famous, to a lesser degree, Dali, and Gaudi, certainly for people who have started thinking about Spain as a tourist destination, Gaudi would be a great attraction, perhaps less known to your average Chinese. They have heard of quite often of Don Quixote, certainly if they're a little bit educated, as many of them are that come to Europe. And, of course, perhaps we shouldn't forget, more important than anything is these days is football, okay? And here we are in Barcelona, and you're having just had a memorable victory last night, then, of course, football is very important for Barcelona and Madrid in particular. But these days, if you perhaps more important than bullfighting or Picasso or anything is, you know, Alonso or someone, even certain Argentinians who are quite good at scoring goals. So it's famous for football, but this is potentially this. From what at one level may seem like, well, I wish it was a different cultural level, but on the other hand, this is a resource and a potential resource that is there to be exploited, I would argue. And I will question a little bit later on, is it being sufficiently exploited for promoting Spanish tourism? Okay, Spain has made its efforts, and I assume in some ways this talk today is part of an effort sponsored by the government to try to promote better understanding for tourism in China. You would be in a better position to tell me whether or not that Plan Turismo China, which was launched in 2011, has worked or not. In fact, I'd be interested to hear from you afterwards. Another important resource, I would say, for Spain has a fairly large Chinese community. It's up there with probably third to France and Italy. Germany is quite big as well, but Spain has it's concentrated in certain areas. I think Barcelona, Madrid are perhaps the largest locations, but it's a significant Chinese community, which, again, is potentially a resource to exploit. Some questions we might take from this discussion of different European destinations. The first one I put there is, how well recognized are your second-tier tourist destinations in China? Okay. Talked about what Spain is known for. It's known for its bullfighting, its art, etc. And we have the football, which leads you to Barcelona, Madrid, and Madrid is also the capital, etc., etc. These are major cities. But what about the other cities? How many other cities in Spain could Chinese people name? Let alone name a tourist resort, a tourist destination in. Tomorrow I'm going to Zaragoza. I think it's going to be a very different kind of situation there. How do you promote somewhere like Zaragoza to Chinese? Okay, so for Spain as a whole, it needs to be thinking not just about the destinations, but what else could Spain be better known for? Food, wine, etc., which are part of a rich cultural heritage, but are perhaps less on that Chinese tourist map. And so how could that be changed? What can you offer in terms of specialist or niche tourism? As I'll be saying a little bit later on, niche tourism is a developing market with Chinese tourists. Those who have already come and done the tour of 15 different European countries in 15 days, and now they want to do something different. Maybe they come for driving fast cars in Germany, or they come for whiskey tasting in Scotland, or maybe you can think of what they might come for Spain for. Okay, how can transport connections be improved? That's perhaps a tricky one. It's not something that either you or I can just improve the number of flights or et cetera. Obviously, there are good rail connections to the rest of Europe and road connections, certainly for this part of Spain. And in fact, I think Barcelona benefits from this vicinity to France, for instance, because tourists might well. I mean, if you think of a tour of Europe, if you land in Germany, you can go over to Paris down to over the Pyrenees, pop into Barcelona, come along the south of France, maybe to Nice or somewhere before dropping down into Italy, then going back up through Austria or Switzerland into Germany again, and then flying home. Okay, so. But to make that to go from Barcelona to Madrid or even down to the very south of Spain adds a lot to the destination. However, things are changing as people are looking for more specialist and more independent travel, which I'll talk about later on, which is an opportunity, I would suggest. Okay, what resources could be better exploited? I've put there, and that's again something that perhaps you're better at answering than myself. So, summarizing this comparison of European countries, Chinese outbound travel and tourism is receiving increasing attention, whether it's through easing visa regulations or starting to introduce some Chinese signage or shop assistants who speak Chinese in fashion shops, etc. It is receiving attention. And more service providers are making Chinese-oriented efforts. But it is patchy, okay? Perhaps understandably. That's not we can't expect everywhere in Europe to suddenly be speaking Chinese, after all. But that patchiness perhaps is something that Europe as a whole, not just Spain, needs to think about trying to connect the dots a little bit and make it slightly more uniform and institutional. This kind of provision is also, I would suggest, more reactive than proactive, by which I mean that once a destination sees that there are lots of Chinese tourists coming, then it's like, oh, okay, well, we'll start translating things in Chinese. Maybe we should have a Chinese shop assistant because we're struggling every day with all these Chinese people who want to buy our bags and we can't talk to them. So it's reactive to the flow. Whereas if you want to think about promoting and better exploiting the opportunities that Chinese tourism are offering Europe, then I think you need to also think more proactively. That means, I'll talk a bit more about that later on, but it means thinking about how to attract people while they're in China rather than when they're here. Okay. As I've pointed out, there's a contrast between well and lesser known destinations. So you have to think about realistically about what is it that Spain has to offer a Chinese audience? How can that be improved or changed or transformed? But it is a changing market that is becoming increasingly complex, less predictable in the sense that when it was all tour groups, and I'll talk a bit about tour groups and individual travellers in a moment, when it was all tour groups, then you could predict where they were going to go, and there were certain people who benefited and others who didn't. But with it becoming more complex, a complex market with more individual travellers, there are more opportunities for a broader range of destinations and service providers. Okay. Let's think about a general profile of Chinese tourists. On average, they're now taking, this is Chinese outbound tourists, I should say, making one trip a year. A couple of years ago, it was 3 to 4 trips every 5 years. Now it's up to 4 or 5 trips every 5 years. So effectively, we're more or less at making one overseas trip a year, the annual holiday, so to speak. Most travel with family or friends, okay? Further down the page there, you can see only 15% travel alone. So the lone Chinese travel, although it is perhaps slightly increasing with students and so on as well, but even they will often travel with friends. It might be a small group of 2 or 3 people. It could be 4 or 5, but they're unlikely to be traveling on their own on the whole. Okay. There is a trend in general towards independent and semi-independent travel. Independent travel, I mean people organizing their own, booking their own hotels, their own flights, etc., etc., deciding where they're going to go, looking for their tourist destinations and deciding what they want to do. Semi-independent, I mean package tours that incorporate a high degree of independence or more or less independence into them. So you might have some organized days and other days where you're free to do what you want, or maybe you buy the flights and then the flights are organized by the travel agent and a couple of destinations, and then you can decide you want to add in Switzerland to your itinerary, you can do it. Okay. So this is an important development, as well as I was saying, niche markets developing, specialist tourism. These are areas that are changing the Chinese outbound travel market. Europe is lagging slightly behind the rest of the world in terms of independent and semi-independent travel, but it's still an important increase. It's only slightly behind. The Asia Pacific and the Americas are ahead by about 10% in terms of numbers. Peak travel times. Chinese are likely to travel in their golden weeks, which are Chinese New Year and then the national holiday in October. There used to be one in May as well. But those 2 weeks, it's when it's a national holiday for a week, and so lots of people have the opportunity to travel because they're off from work as well. So it's a big travel time. But also April and July, that other summer months are also popular, increasingly popular, as people have more flexible holidays as well. Most tourists are fairly young, okay? They are young middle-aged, okay? As you can see, 80% are between 25 and 45. If you want to see a breakdown of that, you can see the large orange and green sectors account for that 25 to 44 age bracket. So they're relatively young and lively, which is a positive thing for Europe. It's also perhaps not surprising, because these are likely to be more educated, have better language skills and so on. Certainly as independent travel becomes important, then being able to speak at least English, if not other European languages, is obviously a help. Thinking about where they come from in terms of income, the average household income of Chinese outbound tourists is around 250,000 renminbi, which is about 30 to 35,000 euros a year, which in China is quite a lot of money. Okay, so they're above, quite well above the national average, which is around 6,500 euros. The lower end, around 20 to 30%, have an income of less than 100,000 renminbi. However, if we think, we might also think back to that the chart that we had of destinations. A lot of those lower end may well be going to Hong Kong, Taiwan, Southeast Asian destinations. So those that are coming to Europe are likely to be in the higher income brackets, simply because of the cost that's involved, if nothing else. As we've been saying, they are big spenders. They spend a lot of money. At the top end, the top 15% are spending as much as 1,250 euros a day on average. Obviously, I don't think they spend, go out every day with 1,000 euros and spend it, but they may blow 10,000-15,000 euros on gifts, you know, £1,000 Gucci bag, which costs £2,000 in China, perhaps, and so on. So this is the top end. At the bottom end, spending is a little more moderate, bottom 30%, between 60 euros and 250 euros a day, which is still a reasonable amount. But again, I would suggest that a large proportion of those will be in that Hong Kong, Taiwan, Macau, and Southeast Asia spending bracket. Those that are coming to Europe are likely to be spending more, perhaps nearer the average, which is around 800 to 900 euros a day, which is why a lot of people are interested in them. Okay. Most visit multiple destinations, as I've said, and they may stay only two or three nights in one hotel. This is starting to change as independent travel becomes more popular and more people are trying it, that it's more relaxed travel. So you have the liberty to stay 3, 4, 5 days in Barcelona. There's plenty to see, instead of being shuffled off on your tour bus back to wherever the next destination is. You know, you might come here, see 3 sites in Barcelona in one day, drive down to Madrid and see you for the next day, and then be back in France the day after, etc., etc. So it's getting longer. Here's a chart for the income. Basically what we were just saying. Again, the orange and the green are the dominant lower income bracket, but still above the national average. But it's probably more the top end of the green sector and the other sectors that are people coming to Europe. In terms of booking and planning, Chinese generally research their trips very well in advance. They don't just casually say, oh, well, I fancy going to Europe, and get off the plane and see what happens to them. They look carefully at where they want to go, what they want to visit. Certainly if they're booking independent travel or semi-independent travel, they're checking out the hotels and what there is to see, how they're going to get there, what the transport links are like, and they research their trips quite carefully. Friends and family recommendations are very important, and a lot of those even friends' recommendations will come via social media and Chinese travelers' websites, the sort of Chinese TripAdvisor and other similar websites are very widely used. And I'll say more about the importance of new media and social media later on. Increasingly, they're booking online or with mobile apps as well, and again, I'll say more about that later on. Travel agents are still used by 30 to 40% of travellers, according to one recent survey, both for information and booking. But that's perhaps less than we might imagine. Okay, so it shows the degree to which people are starting to become more independent. Again, another. This was a survey run, which I'll mention a bit later on, run by a well-known hotel booking website, found that 3-, 4-, and 5-star hotels account for around 75% of hotel bookings. This is for Chinese outbound tourism as a whole, so pointing towards the top end of the market in some ways. However, it's probably a lower proportion in Europe because of cost as much as anything else. And you can go to very good 4- or 5-star hotels in some parts of Southeast Asia, which will cost you less than the cheapest B&B in Europe. So, again, those figures need adjusting for location to some degree. Okay, finally, I want to look at the contrast between Chinese tourists coming to Europe in terms of tour groups and then in terms of independent travel, and then that will finish this first session. Around 60 to 70% of Chinese tourists coming to Europe are still coming in tour groups, so it's still quite a high proportion, but it's decreasing to proportionately. They're likely to, as I said, land in relatively central countries with good connectivity. We've discussed that already. An average trip is likely to be about 10 to 15 days, 10 days probably more than 15, averaging 2-3, maybe even less days in each country. They generally visit the main cities, which in Spain might include Barcelona, of course, not just Madrid, but very often it's just capital cities. If you're going to France, it's Paris, Rome, etc. If there's not a lot of time. But they'll often try and fit in 2 or 3 cities maybe in 1-2 days in one country. So you might have the morning. I mean, I've seen tourist itineraries in the UK, for instance, where have done London, Birmingham, Manchester in 2 days. Okay, so although the transport is fairly close and fairly convenient, you're not spending a lot of time. Once you've taken dining and shopping, etc., into account, then they're not seeing an awful lot. So their sightseeing is often on very tight schedules. Shopping and dining as a group, it's organized, pre-organized destinations quite often. They're likely to be, or more likely to be, first-time travelers, either overseas or perhaps more likely to Europe. They're likely to have traveled overseas before, to have done Southeast Asia maybe, and now they're trying something a bit more adventurous. And the tour groups is a cheaper way to travel, so it's likely to attract people at the lower end of the tourist salary spectrum, perhaps, than independent travel. Consequently, tour groups benefit the easily reachable and proximate countries, and within those countries, the big cities or the main tourist destinations benefit disproportionately. It's not spread out evenly throughout the country. It's highly focused in small areas. Countries that are well-known or have well-known historical importance in the way that I was talking about earlier, you know, Italy and France and so on, benefit obviously as well as desirable destinations for tour groups, because a tour group is more likely to play to stereotypes and the best-known locations for Chinese people in order to sell the package in the first place. Services in some countries, it's been found in France, are often provided by European Chinese, to some degree in Italy as well, because they speak Chinese, they can offer them Chinese food, they know what they're looking for, so they can communicate directly with and make arrangements with the tour operators, etc., etc., strike deals with the tour guides and so on. So that has happened, and it's sometimes a little bit too much of a stereotype that they only go to Chinese businesses. It's not quite that bad, and it's getting better as you have more independent travel, but there is certainly a large degree of truth to it. Tour operators consequently also suit those with a lower educational level and or lack of foreign language skills, a reason even educated people might go on a tour group, or wealthier people might go on a tour group, is if they think that they haven't got very good language skills, so they wouldn't know how to get around. So it's easier to be led around by a tour guide. In the future, numbers are likely to continue to grow in real terms, but perhaps decline proportionately to independent and semi-independent travellers, who I'm going to talk about in a moment. An important change in China is the development and growth of the economy in second and third tier Chinese cities, where new markets are likely to prove important in the future. There's a statistical level, I forget what it is, but when income reaches a certain amount, I think it's about $8,000 a year, it's been found that consumption levels suddenly increase quite quickly. And consumption, of course, also includes outbound tourism. And so once the income levels in second and third tier Chinese cities reach a certain level, you can expect that there's going to be another boost in Chinese outbound tourism. Niche markets may also affect tour groups. There's likely to be more specialist tours, so which are arranged around a theme of some kind. Okay, let's think about the contrast with independent travellers. Okay, they are likely, as I said earlier, still to travel in small groups, friends or family. They're likely to be slightly younger. The younger end of that travel that spectrum that I showed earlier, perhaps including the students, importantly. They're likely to be more experienced travellers. Maybe they've already studied abroad. Maybe they have travelled on several tour groups in the past, etc. Now they want to try travelling on their own. And consequently, they're likely to be more relaxed and spend longer in a wider range of destinations. That's the advantage. There's also indications that there are more repeat visitors. So people who have come maybe on the tour group and now want to go and visit two or three countries that they particularly liked on that visit. The recent research in France found that this is an increasing market for people who liked France and decided they liked France, and presumably this could be for any European country. And so they're starting to say, okay, well, but I've seen Paris, now I'm going to do something else. And so that hopefully is an increasing market. They're still likely to be keen shoppers. That's related to the reasons for shopping, which are to do with social status, to do with gift giving and so on, which I'll talk about in the second session. They're likely to be looking for more likely to be looking for specialist, authentic or adventurous experiences. Something a little, you know, having seen the major tourist sites, they want to see something a little bit different, perhaps go deeper into European cuisines or artistic cultural heritage. Maybe they are fans of Renaissance art, so they may like to go to Italy or wherever. Okay, so it's a deeper kind of more relaxed tourism, which in the end is perhaps better for the European travel industry. So this is a positive trend, I would suggest, for the European travel industry. They're more likely to speak some English, maybe some other European languages, but obviously English as a global language is the most likely. And they are likely to be big new media users, and again, I'll talk more about that in the second half. Consequently, independent travellers potentially offer more business to a broader range of service providers in Europe, as I was saying, and offer greater destinations for greater opportunities for destinations other than capital cities. It's still some way to go before the large tourist destinations cease to dominate the market, but there are indications that there's movement in that direction, and independent travel is certainly positive for that. And new media offer promotional opportunities. Again, I'll say more about that and the importance of that later on. And it's likely to become increasingly important in the future. I think we're there at the end of this session. I don't know how I'm doing for timing. I've not got a clock. Thank you very much. Have we got time for questions? Any questions? If you want to ask questions in Spanish and somebody translates, if you, I don't know, some people maybe, I'm sorry, my Spanish is, I forgot my Spanish years ago.
Si no hi ha preguntes, ara farem un break. Hi ha un coffee preparat per vosaltres en la primera planta i en 20 minuts tornem i comencem amb la segona sessió, que serà més pràctica. Fins ara. Començarem la segona sessió. Merci.
Okay, welcome back everybody. Thank you for returning. The fact that I see people in seats suggests that the first half wasn't too bad. Okay, so this second session, I want to expand a little bit on thinking about the profiles of Chinese tourists that I was talking about in the first session, thinking a bit more about their background, what it is that has made them come to Europe or go on tourist trips to various destinations as well as Europe. So the first section is about knowing your Chinese guests, okay, and then leading into thinking about cultural and linguistic considerations that may be useful for if you find yourselves dealing with Chinese guests, Chinese people, and trying to think of some of the cultural background. I mean, I'm going to oversimplify from an academic point of view, but try and give you some pointers as to some of the cultural background that informs certain expectations and behavior of Chinese tourists. And then finally at the end, I'm going to think quite briefly about how you might be able to use this information to try to think about adapting your offer as someone working in the tourist industries. Obviously, I can only talk in general terms, and if we have 100 people here, you may well be involved in 100 different kinds of enterprises, and everything, any kind of adaptation would have to depend on your own particular circumstances, but hopefully some kind of ideas may be useful. Okay, to start with, it's worth thinking briefly about the background to who Chinese tourists are and how they came to be coming abroad and coming to Europe as well in particular. I mentioned at the beginning of the first session that Deng Xiaoping had an open door policy in 1978. This basically rolled back the state and encouraged private enterprise. Again, this is, I mean, a lot of you may well know all this already, so I'll try and do it fairly quickly. At the same time, I'm oversimplifying and giving a broad generalization, so forgive me for that. But basically, we're talking about the rolling back of the state, the promotion of private enterprise. It happens gradually in some ways, but by comparison to developments in other parts of the world, it's actually a very rapid social, economic, and political change that China has undergone in the last 20, 30 years. The open door policy brought a new emphasis on consumption, which I'll say a bit more about in a moment, exports, economic wealth, and development. It was the economy took over from politics. Instead of talking about class struggle and building a socialist utopia for the future, the emphasis became on getting rich quick or as quickly as possible, on economic wealth, how economic wealth would feed into other aspects of social development and so on. So opening up to a far more, as you all know, capitalist idea, although it's still a communist country, but it's a kind of state capitalism that we have. The open door policy, of course, opened up to non-communist countries, opened up for tourism and so on and so forth. And rapid economic growth and technologization of production and society has ensued, particularly from the 1990s onwards. These economic changes have brought about social changes, huge social changes within China. And for those of you that have visited China recently, if you only visited China recently, it may be difficult to imagine how China was 20, 30 years ago. But there is now much greater social and economic differentiation. the gap between the richest and the poorest in China is huge, at the same time we have the development of an increasingly important middle class, as well as affluent and super rich classes. It depends how you're going to measure classes, and the figures I've got here are coming from a report a couple of years ago by the Boston Consulting Group, who reckon that there are, at that time, around 50, so we're probably now nearer 55, 60 million middle-class households in China. That's households. A household is, of course, generally three people, two adults and one child, only one child, as you will be aware. And that's predicted to rise to about 70 million households by 2020. However, I should emphasize that this is what they're calling middle class. In the same server, above this, they had lower affluent and then higher affluent classes as well, which are also quite big. So this is not all the rich people in China. But it's perhaps the most relevant for most outbound tourists. Other key social changes that have happened, the division between the eastern coastal provinces, which have developed very quickly, Guangdong, Fujian, Shanghai, Shandong province, Beijing, of course, Tianjin, all the large cities and provinces along the eastern coastal border have developed very quickly, not all at the same time, some faster than others, but on the whole, the eastern coastal provinces are where you find a lot of the wealth and the fastest development. Compared to the western hinterland, which has remained more rural, more economically backward, and so on. So you have another kind of social division between east and western China. There are other things we could say, but rural-urban migration, it has become a very big issue in the last 10, 20 years, in that a lot of the economic growth in China, whether it's in terms of factories that are producing all the goods that we consume on a daily basis, or whether it's for the construction of infrastructure projects, roads, railways, etc., etc., most of the labour for that has come from poor people from the countryside who have moved to the cities, to the eastern coastal provinces, to southern China, to the wealthier parts of China, looking for work, and work at generally fairly low wages, but higher than they would get if they stayed at home. So this has also accentuated, made even more visible, the social stratification within China. Social stratification has always existed to some degree, even in the Mao period, between the cities and the countryside, but they were separate places. People from the countryside rarely went to the cities, and people from the cities, apart from being sent down during the Cultural Revolution, rarely went to the countryside. They were kind of two distinct worlds almost, and yet now you have these increasing mixture and confrontation between people from the countryside and becoming aware of what's going on in other parts of China. There are also, of course, problems of corruption that comes with economic growth. The Chinese government has been, under Xi Jinping in the last year or two, has been cracking down on corruption and political rivals at the same time. But corruption is a recognized problem in China. Well, some people, if you see it as a problem, some people might say it's positive, but it depends on who you are and what your viewpoint is, I guess. Most important, perhaps, for what we want to talk about today is the rise of the consumer society, although corruption is also related to tourism because, for instance, a lot of the officials who have acquired illegitimate money within China up until a couple of years ago, the recent crackdown on corruption, were going down to places like Macau, for instance, and spending huge amounts of money in the casinos. Or they were going on European holidays and buying luxury goods, etc., etc. So a lot of that, so corruption does have a link to certainly high-end tourism. The rise of the consumer society is perhaps more important for tourists as a whole, outbound tourists as a whole. Consumption was promoted in the open door policy as a mechanism to boost economic growth. The introduction of the golden weeks that I mentioned earlier on, this was specifically intended to promote consumption, initially within China, to get people spending money in restaurants, starting to travel
you know, to tourist locations around their homes, then increasingly further afield within China, and then eventually also becoming an opportunity for overseas tourism as well. Some people argue that consumption is also a source of party legitimacy, that the ideological vacuum that was left when Maoism was kind of thrown out of the window overnight at the end of the 1970s had to be filled with something, and it's been filled with materialistic desires and consumption habits. There are arguments, you can argue for or against that, and it's a complicated debate, but more or less there's a certain degree of truth to it. So there's an importance for the government to promote consumption, and again, outbound tourism is part of that. Okay, if people are going on foreign holidays, as we all know, it makes you feel good. Okay, it makes you feel better. It makes you feel like you've arrived in a certain social place to some degree, and it gives you broadens your experiences. You can relax on beaches or visit interesting cultural sites, etc., etc. So it makes you feel better. Consumption is an urban-driven phenomenon, though. I was talking about that rural-urban divide, and this in many ways makes consumption also aspirational, as I've put it there. People who come from the countryside are often aspiring to that urban lifestyle as well. So it has an inbuilt self-perpetuating mechanism of... nowadays they talk about the China dream, although it's a little bit different from the American dream, but the idea of the American dream actually... in some ways applies to this notion of consumption in China. The idea that if you work hard, you can accumulate money, get your children into better schools, they're going to be better than you, they'll be able to bring opportunities for you in your old age, etc., etc. This an aspirational aspect of spending money in the right ways. And importantly, very importantly, consumption is a marker of social status, and this does bring us directly to our tourists in a moment. A lot of studies have shown how buying luxury flats, or even just any flat, having a car, certain clothes, being able to have designer objects, are all a matter of ways of demonstrating that you've arrived in the middle classes. Okay, that you are of a certain social status. So, consumption is about social status in many ways. Again, we could go into a lot of complexities, but the bottom line is there. And tourism is part of this equation. If you're able to go on a foreign holiday, or if you're able to travel to Hong Kong, it shows that you are of you've reached a certain wealth level, a certain educational level probably is associated with some of it. And all of this has important implications for understanding who your Chinese guests arriving in Europe are. Remember, for instance, that they are probably very experienced travellers. Okay, they may not look like it. They get off the tour bus and they all look kind of bemused and dazed and like they don't really they feel a bit like fish out of water. But they are very educated, very experienced people, and this means that they have high expectations. If you go to a 4 or 5 star, I was in. Ningbo, a second-tier town, at the weekend for another conference, and I stayed in a 5-star hotel, which I wasn't paying for it, but it costs something like €50 a night, and it was a very good 5-star hotel, a bigger room than you get in Europe. It's in better condition. The service is immaculate. You have people running around saying hello and goodbye to you, and do you want anything all day. So there's a very high level of hospitality industries within China. And these people have traveled, even if they haven't traveled much overseas, they will have traveled extensively in China, and this builds up their expectations of what good service is at certain prices as well. So when they come to Europe and find perhaps a hotel that is not as modern and clean and well-run and polite as the ones that they're used to in China, and it's costing them 3 times as much, it's not surprising that they say, well, what is this? Okay, so remember, these are not fools. Okay, these are very experienced and well-educated and people with high expectations. They're likely to be, as I put there, well-educated, urban residents, relatively wealthy in China. We talked about the income in the first half, and of higher than average social status. And they are to some degree expecting to be recognized as such, certainly amongst themselves. If you can recognize, show that you recognize that they're of a higher social status as well, then all the better for you, okay? Because they will recognize that you recognize. You see, it becomes a kind of reciprocal thing. However, with these generalizations aside, Chinese guests are not all the same, okay? And I want to try and think about some of the differences. And the more that European people in the European tourist industries start to understand the nuances of the differences between Chinese people of different social backgrounds, the more they're going to be able to cater to and please their Chinese guests, I suggest. Obviously, in mainland, thinking about mainland China, and then I'm going to contrast it also to Taiwanese and Hong Kong guests, who show quite significant differences in some ways, even though the main focus of the talk today is really mainland Chinese. Obviously, most, if not all, Chinese are Mandarin speaking. It's the national language, and education is in Mandarin, etc. Apart from perhaps some older people from more remote areas may speak in dialects, but certainly of the age group that we're talking about, they're all Mandarin speakers. However, there are hundreds of local dialects, and that has to be remembered. So, and that makes local differences. There are differences of where you come from amongst Chinese, which can be quite significant. Now, I'm not saying that you have to understand all the details of that, but if you are at least aware that, you know, someone coming from Shanghai might be very proud of that fact in a certain way, and it's part of their identity, and if you can show that you appreciate the fact that they come from Shanghai rather than coming from Guangdong, then okay, it's all, again, all to your benefit in some ways. At least ask them where they come from. Why not? Okay, it doesn't cost you anything. And say, oh, well, and then you show you know a little bit about Shanghai or something. Maybe you've even been there and you can have a conversation. Okay, the emerging social strata that I talked about are also important for educational differences, occupation, residency. That goes back to what I was saying about recognizing that these are people of a certain social status very often. The large, more developed cities like Beijing, Shanghai, Guangzhou, etc., are increasingly used to a very modern, very top technological, cosmopolitan living. Some of you may have been to places like Beijing, Shanghai, Guangzhou. These are international cities now. They have all the Starbucks as well as the big fashion brands and so on. All these shops, very glossy shopping centres, hotels, etc. Very high standards are there. Even if not everyone is going to be using them all the time, it's there, and they know what quality is about, and they are very technologically connected. I currently live in Italy at the moment, and the internet connection I have in Italy is kind of prehistoric compared to what you get in China. So, okay. So, as I said earlier, second, third tier cities are currently undergoing transformations. People from second, third tier cities are a bit different from those from, they're less cosmopolitan than those from the big cities, but with that aspirational consumer culture is part of their certainly part of their background. Chinese will often be quite nationalistic or patriotic, not explicitly, okay? They're not going to come here waving their flags and forcing Chinese nationalism down your throats by any means, not at all. But they can be sensitive if you say something bad about China or suggest or you take anything that could be slightly interpreted as racist towards Chinese or for that matter other Asians sometimes, it can be easy to bring out a certain nationalistic patriotic reaction. So always be, I mean, you might not do it intentionally, but try and be careful about how you would talk about the assumptions you might make about China. Again, the more you know about China, the less likely you are to make any kind of gaffe. If you go around assuming that everyone in China comes from a third world country and they're, you know, decades behind us in the West, then okay, you're going to, not only are you making a bit of a fool of yourself, but you're also going to, they're going to look at you and say, well, what does he know? Okay, so Okay. Other thing there in terms of nationalism, Japan is a sensitive topic and one probably worth avoiding on the whole. Not that everyone is going to react badly, but you never know. You can trigger some very sensitive feelings in relation to Japan because of what happened in the war with atrocities which have never really been fully forgiven in China, perhaps understandably. Chinese are generally not religious, mainland Chinese, because of the history of the last half a century. But increasingly you find there are people who are explicitly religious. They may be Buddhist, Christian, or Muslim. Okay, so don't necessarily assume that they're not religious in some way. They may have dietary expectations, whether it be vegetarianism or not eating pork or whatever it may be. Or some not eating beef as well. Okay, I don't want to spend too long talking about Hong Kong, Macau and Taiwan because that's not really the main theme of today's talk, but it does throw up some interesting contrasts. If you look at Hong Kong and Macau, they're Cantonese speaking, so they speak a different dialect, and they're quite proud of that, and it's very much part of their identity. They see themselves as distinctive from mainland Chinese because of the different history, because of the cultural backgrounds, where the relationship to Europe through Britain and Portugal. There's a strong Hong Kong identity, and I would say also Macau identity. People from Macau also might like to differentiate themselves from people from Hong Kong, even though they work interact with each other in a very common, very similar in some ways. Okay. There are also recently there have been growing antagonisms with mainland China, not just the demonstrations that you may have heard about in Hong Kong, but if you talk to people in Hong Kong, there's this sense of an invasion, and that's words that they've used to me, of Chinese tourists. Okay, it's related to tourism again, because Hong Kong is a small place. Some of you may have been there. It's a relatively small place. It has a population of 7 million people, and they're having around 70 million Chinese tourists coming every year. Okay, so you can think of the numbers of people, and that, and there are bigoted stories also in the Hong Kong press, sort of saying, well, Chinese tourists don't behave nicely, they spit, etc. Interestingly, there's kind of stereotypes that the West has been producing about China for a long time in some ways. But so all this is really building up to the idea of trying to say that people from Hong Kong and Macau are different. If you have Hong Kong and Macau guests, try to distinguish that they're not from, you know, that don't confuse them with mainland Chinese. Similarly, I would say with people from Taiwan. They do generally speak Mandarin, again, because Mandarin has been the national language since 1949. However, many will speak Hokkien dialect if they're sort of indigenous Taiwanese. The indigenous Taiwanese, there are actually what are called Taiwanese Aboriginal peoples who precede the Han Chinese, but Han Chinese of long standing were likely to speak Hokkien dialect because they come from Fujian province, which is just over. So there are a lot of links, cultural and increasingly, of course, economic links between Taiwan and Fujian. But they, again, have very distinct sets of ideas of divergent histories. And, of course, within Taiwan, politics is also very divided. There are those who are ultimately looking towards reunification with China, and there are those who would look for Taiwanese independence in the future. So it's quite a sensitive political topic for mainland Chinese and Taiwanese that in some ways, unless you're very sophisticated about the possible complications of that debate, it was probably one to avoid getting into. But it does, again, my point is to show that Taiwanese will think of themselves as, they won't think of them, they'll probably think of themselves first and foremost as Taiwanese, okay? And then if you say, does that mean you're Chinese? Of course I'm Chinese, okay? They're Chinese as well. But they're first, a bit like people from Hong Kong. People from Hong Kong are all Chinese, but most of them are Chinese. But they will think first and foremost about their identity as being from Hong Kong. Again, different religious backgrounds and so on. I don't want to spend too long on this. Okay, knowing your Chinese guests a bit more, this is really thinking about mainland Chinese again, I should say. Okay, statistically, tourists are marginally more likely to be female, although I saw a survey of tourists from three or four years ago, which suggested that there were slightly more male. So it's not really a big difference. Business travellers are more likely to be male, but business travel is a relatively small portion of that outbound tourism and travel and tourism market that we're talking about, around 6 to 10% probably. So most of the travel that we're talking about is tourism rather than business. Independent travellers, as I said earlier, are more likely to be young, under 35. The most popular tourist activities are almost universally named as sightseeing, dining and shopping, okay? Not a big surprise there, perhaps. Importantly, as I've been trying to say, travel is a sign of social status. That's something to remember. And that feeds into other activities and behaviour. Shopping is often for gifts, and gifts are a matter of maintaining social relationships in China. I can say a little bit about that maybe later on. But you give gifts as a means of showing that you've been somewhere. So it's that saying who I am. But it's also a matter of showing respect to other people, maybe to family, friends, bosses, business connections, etc. You might be expected to bring a gift back. So shopping is often not only, but often for gifts. I've taken two sort of sections. I mean, I appreciate that you're not all coming from hotels or tourist destinations, but I've got two lots of questions. What are they looking for in a hotel, and what are they looking for in a tourist destination? I can't do what are they looking for in a souvenir shop, and what are they looking for in a restaurant, etc. So I can't do everything, okay? But a lot of the things that apply certainly for hotels apply for other sectors, certainly restoration and I think to some degree shopping as well. They're looking for polite, courteous, respectful and obliging service. Again, that is expected, and I'll explain a little bit more later on why that might be. Flexible and fast service. They expect you to be willing to go that extra step, not just sit behind the till and wait for them. Okay, this is not talking about hotels, I guess, but in hotels, they want you to be able to be obliging. Okay. They're looking for free Wi-Fi. That's one that goes back to they're technologically connected. They don't expect to pay for Wi-Fi as well. That's kind of why would you charge for it? Okay. Which is increasingly less an issue, I think, anyway, in most hotels. Complete and precise information. They don't like to be given, you know, they like to know that you've told them what they have to do, where they have to go, what time they have to be there, and they'll do it, okay? But they don't want to be sort of left hanging around with half the information, I'll tell you later, etc. So try and be precise and complete. In a way, these are really things that you would think about for most tourists, I think, to some degree. But these are the things that have come out in surveys of Chinese tourists in recent years. Restaurants and good room service are important because they eat quite a lot in the hotel, maybe more than guests from other countries. So they want convenience. They want to be able to call up room service and get a meal, maybe in the evening, maybe late at night. They want the possibility of eating in the hotel. I mean, again, surveys have shown that they will eat 50% of the time, probably eat in the hotel, which I think is more than a lot of other tourists might do. It's for convenience and speed and so on that often leads it. They like, obviously, as we all do, we like something familiar, Chinese food, especially breakfast. I think that's, again, maybe it's a cross-cultural thing. There's something about breakfast that people find like to stick with the familiar, okay? And Chinese are no different to anyone else. Providing Chinese breakfast is not necessarily easy, but it needn't necessarily be quite as difficult as it might seem. You don't necessarily have to have a Chinese chef, but it might be a good idea, okay, depending on how big your hotel is and how much money you've got, but that's another issue, okay. Still carrying on with hotels, Chinese language provision is, of course, welcome, and the larger chains of hotels are increasingly having Chinese-speaking staff as well as possibly signage. If you haven't got Chinese language signs, of course, always have signs with symbols that are internationally recognized rather than writing it in Spanish or probably even worse, Catalan or English for that matter, or Italian or wherever you're from. They like convenient shopping opportunities. That means shops either in or near hotels. Okay, obviously, if you run a hotel and you haven't got shops in your hotel, then you can't do much about what the other people around you are doing. But you could maybe work out ways in which you can get them, tell them how they could get to shopping destinations easily, provide a map with the taxi number or with the bus routes or the tram route if it's easy and convenient. Tell them how to get there. Things that have been classically recognized, slippers in rooms. If you go to a Chinese hotel, then you always have slippers in the room. Tea, coffee and kettles, they like to be able to make a cup of tea. It's part of general hospitality, which I'll talk a little bit about in a moment. A good range of complimentary toiletries. People don't like to travel light and will often expect to use what's provided in the hotel rather than bringing necessarily their own, so they like that. Quite often single beds are preferred to double or king size beds. Okay, we'll come back to some of those issues of hospitality in a moment, but let's think a little bit about a tourist destination. What are they looking for in a tourist destination? The first thing I've put here is a clear storyline or a reason to visit. They need to, you know, if they're going to be taken somewhere or told to go somewhere, they need to have a good reason for understanding why they're there, okay? And that may be probably related to history, fame, or beauty, as I put here. It's a historically important site. It's famous because all the tourists come here. It's the most famous, the Eiffel Tower being a good example, for instance. I mean, it doesn't have any great historical importance, the Eiffel Tower, but everyone goes to it because it's famous. Beauty, beautiful scenery, beautiful architecture, etc., etc. Those are likely. So a clear understanding of why they should visit something. And related to that is photo opportunities. If it's to be able to be photoed, have your photo taken in front of the place where somebody gave a famous speech, or where a certain battle was, or in front of a beautiful scenery, etc. Photo opportunities are important, not just because we all take photos, but they're also part of the self-promotion, self-reporting, and I'll talk about this again related to new media later on. Taking photos and being able to communicate what they're doing during and after travel is very important. Chinese language explanations and information are also, of course, important. Again, I mentioned that in relation to hotels. Chinese websites are useful because, as I said earlier, a lot of preparation goes into planning travel, and as independent travel becomes more important, the ability to read things in Chinese is of course, very welcome, even if a lot of the better educated, wealthier tourists that come to Europe may have quite a good English, and so they can read the English version of your website perhaps. Nonetheless, they'll read more quickly and more conveniently and easily in Chinese. I can read Chinese websites, but if I can find it in English and it's the same thing, I'll read it in English because it's quicker, it's easier, and I don't make any mistakes. Okay, so links to China. I mentioned this kind of thing with Deng Xiaoping and Zhou Enlai in France earlier as an example. But there may be other links. It could be other famous Chinese people who have been there. There are certain famous writers, for instance, from the early 20th century who studied and lived in France and the UK. I don't know about Spain, to be honest, but possibly there are some. It's worth finding out if there were any. And these become places. So, for instance, Chinese tourists who go to Cambridge like to see the place where certain writers visited in the UK. They're also looking for educational value for children. Education is very important for Chinese, and especially with the one-child family policy, there's a lot of expectations placed on the child. And so if, as an addition to seeing something beautiful and having fun and taking photos and all the rest of it, there's something that the kids are likely to learn out of it, then of course that's also welcome. Okay, now I want to think about some of the cultural attitudes which perhaps shape some of these tourist behaviours. I'll go through these quite quickly. I could spend a fair bit of time on each of them. But in relation to shopping, brand consciousness is very important, but also in terms of relationship to hotel chains and that kind of thing. People are very aware, very brand conscious in the sense of they want to buy famous brands. Okay, if it's certainly if it's designer goods and fashion industry, they want it to be a brand that they know. But also they're aware of brands in hotels. If certain chains are considered to be high-class hotels, and they can say, you know, we stayed at whichever, I won't name any, and not show any preference, but if they say, you know, we went to this hotel, then it maybe gives them, that comes back to that social status. But also if they receive good service, I mean, I've said that they're discerning but loyal. If they receive good service in a certain hotel chain, they're likely to return to it. Not necessarily to the same hotel, they're likely to go somewhere else, but if they know that this hotel chain provides a good service, they're likely to say, okay, I'll go back there to again. The desire for the new and the authentic. New can be very broadly understood. It could be new to them personally, in the sense that this is their first time in Europe, so therefore they want to see lots of new things. They want to see France and Germany and Spain and Italy and everywhere, okay? So they want a little bit of everything that's new. But it can also mean for those return visitors or second-time visitors or the independent travellers also looking for something that they haven't seen before. So there's this desire which actually expands the market, pushes people into new places, less likely to go back to the same places that they visited before. And as the independent sector increases, this desire for something that's authentic becomes whatever authentic is, of course, but the idea of something which is, you know, typically from Barcelona or typically Spanish or typically from wherever they are, okay. Networking and gift giving, I kind of mentioned, shapes to shopping experiences. Perhaps I won't say any more on that. I've said enough already for the moment. Face and respect are very important Chinese cultural values and attitudes, and I'm going to say a bit more about face in a moment, so I'll skip that as well and say more in a minute. National pride I've kind of mentioned as well. Appreciation of flexibility and amenability, that goes back to what I was saying about hotels, where people like to see that you're going that extra step, not just in hotels but elsewhere, that you're willing to go and see if you've got the size of the t-shirt in the warehouse if it's not there. You know, that kind of showing willing is appreciated and pays you back eventually. Not familiarity. Familiarity is in some ways a contradiction to the new and the authentic, because, you know, somebody who's coming to look for authentic Spanish food maybe doesn't, you think, well, they're not going to be eating Chinese food. But again, like tourists from many places, I mean, if I travel in China for any considerable amount of time and I'm eating Chinese food every day, all day for 3 weeks, by the time I get to my lump of cheese at the end of that trip, that I'm really pleased about it. You know, there's something about familiarity again, particularly in terms of food, but also other home comforts, and that goes back to the offer of hotels that I was talking about earlier. Collective behaviour is also important again, we could say a lot about this in Chinese society. Collective behaviour, maybe the family group, maybe talking about a collective, but it's less individualistic, even though there are individualism, trends of individualism in as China becomes more materialistic, etc., etc. Nonetheless, there's a strong emphasis on the family, there's a strong emphasis on the social group. If you're travelling as a tour group, there is a certain degree of expectation to behave in a certain way according to that group. Okay, so to try and go in a little bit deeper in terms of cultural values, when I'm teaching, I must admit, usually try not to start with Confucius, because there's this stereotype that everyone is Confucian in China. Okay, I must have pushed it by mistake. Okay, I try to avoid stereotyping Chinese as Confucian, but it's a useful starting point for a talk like this, where I've got a limited amount of time to go into great detail and complicate it in an academic way. It's useful for thinking about some of these cultural attitudes that I've just been talking about. Okay, perhaps the key thing from Confucianism to remember is that it has an emphasis on harmonious social relationships. Okay, it's about getting on well with other people. Okay. I mean, again, it's not to say that everyone in China gets on harmoniously, etc., etc. Okay, we're talking about generalizations at a very broad cultural level here. But it's also hierarchical, and that does inform this emphasis on social relationships, to a degree hierarchy, and recognizing social status that I was talking about earlier is informed here. And it's also focused on proper behavior, behaving in an appropriate manner, both in terms of being polite and courteous, which is I was mentioning earlier, but it's also about conducting yourself appropriately in relationships. So that means making gifts at the appropriate time, etc. I've got some of the classic Chinese terms that relate to these issues. Xiao, filial piety, how you respect your parents, and so on, for instance. The idea of Li, which is ceremony or ritual. It means polite, getting it's Li Mao in the contemporary Chinese means being polite, okay, but it's a matter of doing the right thing, okay. Righteousness is often, or it's often translated as righteous, which is a bit of a clumsy translation, but Yi is also about dealing with, for instance, the nature of friendship, okay, the nature of a relationship is how it's conducted. Okay, these are classic Chinese ideas, and you won't find people in contemporary China sitting there telling you, oh, well, it's not very filial or not very righteous or whatever. But it's nonetheless perhaps part of that broader cultural understanding that lies underneath a lot of social behavior. And it comes into everyday life, and I think I give you some examples. Dealing with your superiors in a business or in a workplace situation, you have to show the right kind of respect, you have to behave in an appropriate manner, you give or don't give gifts of a certain kind, etc., etc. These kind of social behaviors are in some ways informed by this sort of understanding. Treatment of guests, I'm going to say a bit more about hospitality in a moment, is also about treating people appropriately and in nurturing of relationships in the appropriate manner. Dining and formal situations often have a hierarchical aspect to them. I did have a map. I was going to explain about dining arrangements that trying to cut down the length of the talk a bit. But if you go for a business meal or a formal meal of some kind, there's a hierarchy of seating placement. The most important person should be seated opposite the door, and then the guests of decreasing importance go round to the other side of the table. So, again, it's about a social practice. Social practice is building in a sense of hierarchy into it, okay, social hierarchy and recognition of social status. Gift giving, again, I've mentioned that before. Okay, I'm going to look a little bit more detail at the ideas of hospitality and face, as I think they are important perhaps for the hospitality industries in many ways. Strong emphasis on hospitality. It's important to make guests feel comfortable and feel at home. This is not just about hotels. I'm talking about if you're invited to a Chinese person's home, they will do everything they can to make you feel comfortable, offer you something to drink, something to eat. In fact, a common greeting is, have you eaten yet? And the idea is, if you were to reply, which you probably wouldn't, but if you were to reply, well, no, I haven't eaten yet, then there's a kind of moral obligation to try and offer something. Okay, so the idea of hospitality is very important for Chinese people. And so knowing how to treat Chinese guests translates over into expectations of hospitality industries. And hotels, as I was saying earlier, in China take this very seriously. You get a strong sense that you are the guest, you are the honored person when you go to a Chinese hotel. People are fairly deferent. That doesn't mean they're subservient, but they are deferent to you. They treat you as a guest. The client is king. That kind of attitude is all to do with notions of good hospitality and what is expected. So from a Western perspective, we might often actually prefer to go to a hotel where it's a bit more relaxed and you can have a bit more of a chat with the hotel proprietor. But that might not go down so well with the Chinese, who are expecting, you know, a certain degree of formality and respect. So commercial hospitality is expected to be obliging, available, courteous and deferent, as I've put there. Face is all about, you've probably heard about face. It's about good reputation, respect and honour, giving face. We also have this saying in English, I don't know whether it's used in Spanish as well. It's a key concept for dealing with people successfully in China. You have to be very careful about face. I mean, it's not that complicated, but if you follow a few basic rules, probably most of the time you'll get away with things. And as foreigners, we're often excused for not understanding it because it's not part of our culture, perhaps. So if you do make mistakes, then you'll probably be forgiven, or else they'll just say, oh, well, he or she is foreign. No, so. But if you can show that you do understand it, then it's useful. It's again about the appropriate conduct of relationships. Giving and saving face are vital. Losing face is shameful. It's about shame. Okay. You give face to others by making compliments to them in front of other people, a demonstration of respect. So this morning, the introduction that I had was very respectful, was giving face to me because it kind of exaggerates my great importance in the world, but it makes me feel good and it makes you think that I'm more important than I am. Okay, so it's actually, it's all building up face. Face is increased through positive comments made about you by others in front of other people. Okay, and face is lost when you are publicly criticized or linked to some kind of negative behavior. So as a service provider, you should be careful about this. Let's think of a trivial example, perhaps. If, say, there was a problem with the bill in the hotel, don't talk to the person responsible in front of all the other Chinese guests, and maybe not even in front of the other foreign guests. Maybe take them aside and deal with it, because it's probably just a little mistake, okay? The credit card didn't clear. We've all had that experience, or whatever it may be. But if you kind of make an issue of it, that there's something wrong and maybe you're a bit brusque about it in front of the other people, then you maybe, and the person who's paying is quite likely to be the most important member of the group, remember that. So they may be paying for, whether it's for the family or for the other business people, if they're paying, they're likely to be the most important person, so you need to give them face and not let them lose face over something which is trivial or whatever. So criticism, if they would say there was a problem with something broken in the room, etc., deal with it. So that kind of thing is giving face. Okay. This is kind of a list of some of these are quite well-known cultural and linguistic considerations as we move towards the conclusion. Giving things with two hands, like name cards, receipts, etc., is respectful. You don't, let alone throw it to someone or just dump it down on the table. Give it with two hands, look at the person and give it respectfully. So again, it's about respect, showing, giving face and social status. Avoid numbers, the number four. Different people from different parts of China have more or less worried about this. People from Hong Kong and Guangdong are particularly, quote, superstitious about these kinds of things and spend huge amounts of money for auspicious telephone numbers and car number plates and that kind of thing. It's spread as an interest, you might say, into other parts of China as well, especially amongst business people, that kind of thing. But avoid four because it's a homonym for death. Okay, so if you give someone don't give them the room 4 or 14 or on the fourth floor if you can avoid it. I mean, not that it's necessarily going to be a major problem. But if you can avoid it, it's better. Auspicious numbers, 8, 6, 3, and 9. So put prices. If you have a lot of Chinese visitors and you rely a lot on Chinese business, put your prices as, don't put 150 euros, put 168 euros. Okay, so not only do you get 18 euros more, but it's also an auspicious number. Pay attention to face. I've talked about that. Social status is important. Again, I've said a bit about that. Try to recognize who is the senior member of a group. again, you might be able to do that by who did the booking, who's doing the paying, but you can also often tell by the social interaction amongst the people that people are more deferent to a certain member of the group. Even if you can't understand what they're saying, you can often tell by body language. So try to understand that if you can. Differentiate kind of travellers that I mentioned before. If you can, try to learn some Chinese language. Even if it's just a ni hao, just a little hello, or where are you from or something, and then you have to say, I'm sorry, I don't speak anymore. But at least you've made the effort. Now, that will be appreciated. That will be appreciated by Chinese people. Because you're also giving face to Chinese people as a whole and showing the importance of learning Chinese language in a foreign context. It's part of recognizing China's growing importance in the world. Family names come first. This is a practical thing. So if you have the name is, say, Wang Xiaobin, then it will be Mr. Wang, okay? Wang is the surname. Use polite forms of address. Use the Mr., Mrs., or whatever the appropriate term in Spanish is. And also, sir or madam, again, it's a matter of being polite. Avoid making them wait if possible, especially if they're on tight schedules, okay? Then tight tour group schedules, for instance. Making them wait could be disrupting their plans. Smile and be friendly. Avoid saying direct no's. This is something perhaps it's more appropriate for other business contexts, but it may also come into the tourism industry in some ways. But if you could, Chinese people will generally try to avoid saying no to you. If you ask them to do something, or we don't make a big thing about it. If the answer's no, then the answer's no, and we just like to hear it straight away. But with Chinese people, it's a matter of, again, perhaps losing face. If we say no too directly, then it means that you're not showing a degree of respect, or you're not making an effort. So the answer might be, okay, we'll see what we can do about it, okay? And then maybe later on you have to say, oh, well, I tried and it didn't work out, I'm really sorry, etc. But if you can avoid saying a direct no, because it may be that later on you're able to say yes, in fact, okay? So it's worth remembering. Show interest in China. I've kind of talked about that already. Don't confuse them with Japanese if you can possibly avoid it. I suspect Japanese don't like being confused with Chinese as well. Not so sure about that, but I imagine that's probably the truth. And try to think of adapting services if you can for Chinese, if you've got a lot of Chinese clientele. Don't necessarily expect them to like what you're offering in general. And now to close, then, some thinking about what that kind of adaptation might mean. It may not be anything particularly complicated or costly. As I've put there, a smile costs you nothing. Okay, so if it's just a matter of being respectful, deferent, and so on, then you know that doesn't take a lot of training, it doesn't cost you a lot of money, and you can do it easily. And you've already made some kind of adaptation. Okay, it's obviously it's not all necessarily that simple, and varying ranges of investment may or may not be required for doing these things. But there are also increasingly, if you are a small hotel operator, for instance, or running a shop, you can learn from what the big boys have already done. Okay, various large hotel chains have launched Chinese-oriented welcome programs: Hilton, Huanying, Marriott, Liu, Intercontinental, Hualux, etc., etc. Okay, these have the big chains have all competed with each other to try and be more welcoming to Chinese guests, seeing the importance of them. But you can learn from what they've done. They've done the research. They've paid people like me to go and do a report. They've done their surveys. They've surveyed their own clients, etc., etc., and they've found the results. And you can tell what the results were by what they're now doing. So copy it, okay? Good Chinese practice as well is to learn what other people are doing well and do it yourself. So what these packages generally include are welcome letters, maps and brochures in Chinese, for instance, Chinese TV channels or films, 24-hour Mandarin hotlines, having Chinese-speaking staff. Obviously, if you're a small operation, that may not be so feasible. But if you do manage to target and successfully target Chinese clientele, think about employing a Chinese person. Why not? Or a Chinese graduate, someone who can at least do the do the simple things and at least create some kind of contact. Slippers, robes, kettles, coffee, tea, toiletries in rooms. You can find all this kind of information on the websites of these large hotel chains. They'll tell you what they're doing. Chinese food and or menus. That is obviously may take some kind of investment and a degree of ability depending on the size of your business as to whether you can do that. But menus may be not be such a big investment. Chinese food may be, okay. After all, a lot of small restaurants, I mean, I went to a small restaurant last night and they produced the menu in English, so why not? They must have paid someone to translate it or found someone to translate it. Just get someone to translate it into Chinese as well. Why not? It doesn't cost you a lot. Chinese breakfast options they offer as well. Adapter plugs, again, that's something that doesn't cost you anything if you've got a plug for an adapter for Chinese plugs, etc. Chinese newspapers, of course, are increased. Actually, I would say it's almost symbolic because people less and less read Chinese newspapers because everything is on their mobile device, which we'll talk a little bit about in a moment. Think proactively, not reactively. I kind of touched on this earlier. If you really want to, if you really want to improve or increase your numbers of Chinese guests, you need to think about trying to get them before they become your guests, trying to attract them to you, and taking proactive measures. And I'll say what that might entail in terms of new media later on as one possibility. If you've got the money, go to China. If you've never been to China, go to China for fact-finding and familiarization. I worked out you could probably go and stay in decent 4 or 5-star hotels in, 5 or 6 different cities in China for maybe 2,000, 2,500 euros for a 10-day trip. Okay, for some people that's a lot of money. For others it's less. It's also a holiday. But you can use it as a... If you can go and see what I'm talking about with Chinese hotels, go and see what they offer, how they treat people, what they expect. Go and see what the shopping is. How do the Chinese guests get treated in luxury item shops, etc., etc. You can learn a lot by going to China. Use internet and social media. This is partly what I mean by proactive and not reactive. A Chinese website is not necessarily enough. Okay, quite a lot of people have translated their website into Chinese, but then not a lot of people necessarily read it. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. So it's also a matter of making sure that the traffic is targeted towards your website. So that may mean taking further steps to try and promote your website in social media of various different kinds. Think flexibly. What can make Spain more attractive to Chinese tourists? I kind of got you thinking about that in the first half, I think. Here's an example that struck me. A couple of weeks ago, I was in Hong Kong and found myself in Pizza Express with my family. And I looked at the menu and thought, this is interesting. Okay, there are two things that were interesting. One was the menu and the other was the way that Chinese people in Hong Kong were eating pizza or eating in Pizza Express, which is not necessarily the same thing. In fact, if you look at this menu, I think there are several things that are quite striking about it, certainly compared to a Pizza Express menu in London or somewhere else. I don't know if you have Pizza Express here or not. The first thing is it's highly visible, visual. Okay, there are photos. There are more photos than text. Okay, if you go to a Chinese tea house, certainly in Hong Kong, you find there's a photo with each dish quite often. So that you see what it is that you're ordering. Not only is this good, of course, for people who don't necessarily speak the language, because if you give me a menu in Spanish, I can understand half of it because of familiarity with Latin languages, but there'll be certain things I just don't understand what it is. Whereas if you show me a thing with pictures, I can say, oh, okay, that's good. Oh, that looks nice. I'll have one of those and two of those. Okay. So that was the visuality has various positive aspects to it. The other thing that struck me is it doesn't look like a pizza menu. Okay, this is Pizza Express, but we have one sort of small picture of a pizza up there, and all the rest is other things. Okay, it doesn't look like a pizza menu. And what it does look like, especially with the picture on the right over here, it looks like Chinese food. Okay, it it's little bits. You can imagine eating this with chopsticks, okay? It's cut up into bite-sized portions, and you can eat it. You could eat it in a Chinese way. And in fact, that perhaps gives the clue away for what's interesting about the rest of the menu. It's also about small dishes that look slightly more Chinese in their presentation and are also clearly about sharing, okay? And in fact, that's the other thing that was interesting in Pizza Express, is that the Chinese people in the Hong Kong Chinese people, these were mainly, in Pizza Express, how they would order the Italian way of eating a pizza is that everyone orders their pizza and their beer or Coke or whatever it is that they're drinking, and then they have an ice cream afterwards, okay? You have your pizza. But for a Chinese, having all that pizza that's all the same, one flavour, it's a bit of a drag by the end of it. And why should I do that when there are all these other things on the menu, okay? If you go for a Chinese meal, as you'll all be aware, you share things. You have lots of different dishes, and you have a bit of this and a bit of that, okay? And people in Pizza Express ate in that way as well. Order a pasta dish, maybe two different pizzas, and a range of the little dippy things. And in the end, they've got 5, 6, 7 different dishes on the table, and you can take bits and pieces. Why not, okay? And in some ways, the menu reflects that, I think. The other thing that struck me, when I'm going to Spain and I'm going to give this talk, is that it also made me think, I don't know, I'm not an expert on Spanish food, but it made me think of tapas, okay, and how thinking of how tapas lends itself so well to Chinese ideas of food, okay, Chinese cuisine. Not Chinese cuisine, because the tastes, the flavors are obviously different, but the fact that you have in a tapas menu, you have a wide range of different flavors, ranging from the salty to the sour to the sweet to the crispy and to the soggy, etc. The whole range of different culinary experiences that you can have in a tapas menu, which could be presented in this kind of way, would be, I think, could be exploited and lent to Chinese people quite well. Okay, those are the kinds of things I was saying about the menu. Finally, then, I've been promising you some things about new media, and I'll be quick because I think I'm overrunning. There are around 650 million internet users in China these days, with 80% accessing the internet via mobile phones. The national penetration rate is 46%, but in the big cities, Beijing, Shanghai, Guangzhou, which are the main sources of current sources of Chinese outbound tourists to Europe, they're 65% or more. Okay, so everyone's got their smartphone. Everyone, 99% of the tourists that come to Europe will have their smartphone. Okay, and they'll be using their smartphone while they're here. Okay, to access social media apps, particularly WeChat, Weixin as it's known, which is like WhatsApp, that kind of thing, if you know what I mean. These are also other figures which I can go through quickly. Basically, at least 50% are using websites and new media as a means of accessing information, of making bookings, of accessing review websites before they travel. That's what I was saying about preparation before you travel. 84%, according to one recent survey, share their photos and experiences on social media. Okay, and again, I've put at the bottom there, remember that travel is a demonstration of social status. It goes back to what I was saying earlier. This is the results of that survey. There's the 84% on the left, with all social media. And you can see WeChat, Weibo is like the Chinese version of Twitter, well above 60% of people are using these for sharing their photos and experiences, either during or after their trip. And you can go down. All of these are electronic forms, one form or another, becoming more and more old school as you get to the right, until you get to the little one at the bottom, which is printed photos. Okay, maybe none of us spend a lot of time printing our photos out these days, but this shows how far things have moved towards new media. Okay. So, concluding points. Increasing numbers are going to continue to rise. The market is changing. More specialist niche tourism that I've mentioned. More independent travellers bring more and broader opportunities. This is changing tourist behaviour. They're becoming more, as I said, more relaxed, longer stays in certain places, more flexible, etc. The tourism market is still developing in China. There is a lot of potential for further growth. It's not peaking out yet. Second and third tier cities are likely to be important in the future, as I mentioned before. These are some ideas for perhaps what is needed from European industry, tourist industry providers. More proactive preparation and service provision. New media offers the potentiality to do that. If you can promote yourself on Chinese new media, you can do that from Europe. You don't have to make expensive trips to China in order to promote yourself. You don't have to have an agent in China necessarily. Get yourself known. Maybe get a Chinese person to help you do it, of course. But get someone to be putting your website, preferably in Chinese, onto Chinese social media, etc. Get your Chinese guests, if you have them, ask them to report it. Say, take a photo. Can you put it up on Weibo for me? Or whatever the social media they're using. More Chinese language provision and intercultural training is required. There is some patchy, as I said, provision, but it could perhaps be more uniform. More nuanced understandings of Chinese tourists, I've said. I've also put efforts to attract Chinese tourists need to be planned and coordinated. And that's, I think, is a key issue, okay? Because it's all very well somebody who runs a shop in Barcelona trying to attract Chinese tourists, spending money and getting everything translated into Chinese. But then if the visa arrangements and the promotion is not there to get the Chinese tourists to come here, it's wasted money, okay? At the same time, there's no point in the government making it easier with visa regulations and then the tourist board promoting Spanish tourism in China, and then they all come here and find that nothing is ready for Chinese tourists. So it's a matter of coordinated activities. Otherwise, things are not going to work. So coordinated and planned preparation. Tourist offices could play a leading exemplary role. I mean, that's a matter, obviously, for local government or for central government to decide on whether they want to invest the money there. But tourist offices send people to hotels, they send people to tourist destinations, and if they are seen to work well with Chinese operators, not only do they facilitate Chinese tourism, but they also lead a good example for other people in the tourist industries to follow. Finally, as I've said, new media is fundamental, I think, if you want to really be part of that future, you have to be starting to think about using new media to attract and nurture Chinese clientele. I'll stop because I've probably gone into your time, I'm afraid. Okay.
Thank you very much, Professor. Ahora comenzamos la tercera sesión, que está dedicada fundamentalmente a casos prácticos y que impartirá una colaboradora habitual de Casa Asia, Joan Gao, que también es profesora de lengua en la Escuela Oficial de Idiomas. Un aplauso para ella.
Thank you very much, Dr. Latem. Que nos acaba. Bueno, voy a hacer la presentación en castellano. El Dr. Latem nos acaba de explicar, ¿no? Desde el panorama hasta aspectos culturales, hasta aspectos de práctica habitual sobre el tratamiento al turismo chino. Pues ahora voy a completar sobre todo en detalles, o sea, voy a contar sobre todo anécdotas, detalles de estos aspectos que conceptualmente ya está cubierto. Entonces, sobre todo antes de empezar, yo vivo aquí 6 años, he tenido muchas conversaciones con la gente de aquí, sobre todo del sector turismo y retail. Muchos me han preguntado en China, la comida china, los chinos, la costumbre. Antes de nada, me gustaría hacer una mención porque un 60% de la población mundial está en Asia, o sea, vive en Asia, por lo cual es difícil hablar de Asia como un bloque, y en China, como ya sabemos que es un país con tamaño de continente, lo cual es difícil también para nosotros. Pensamos, por ejemplo, los chinos que comen o los chinos normalmente que hacen o que compran, porque hay realmente muchas chinas, hay muchas lenguas chinas, hay muchas comidas chinas. Para la mayoría de los chinos, un vuelo de 3 o 4 horas en la China continental es un vuelo nacional normal, lo cual, sin ir a ninguna de las islas. Por lo tanto, y también estamos acostumbrados de viajar dentro del país sin entender a la gente. Quiere decir que muchas veces, si viajo a Cantón, entiendo mucho más el catalán que el cantonés, lo cual... quiere decir que a la hora de tratar a clientes chinos o turistas chinos fuera de China, también siempre tener en cuenta que estamos enfrentando una realidad muy compleja incluso para los mismos chinos, lo cual ha mencionado el doctor Lassen muchos detalles de preguntar, por ejemplo, usted de dónde viene, ¿no? De qué parte de China es, cómo es el clima ahí. No se puede preguntar cómo es el clima en China. Es muy importante. Antes de todo, la idea de una complejidad de realidad. Bueno, vamos a repasar, antes que nada, unos conceptos que han sido mencionados. Mienzi, lo cual es la cara, lo que ven de mí, lo que piensan de mí. Ya muchos piensan, por ejemplo, aquí en Europa en general, bueno, en países latinos un poco menos, pero en Europa el gusto personal, ¿no? La decisión es personal. Si decido comprar un abrigo es porque a mí me gusta y el precio me parece bien y me queda bien. Pero en China muchas de estas decisiones sencillas, diarias, tiene que ver con una relación social. Entonces, un vendedor que realmente conoce la cultura china puede decir, wow, este abrigo le queda súper, fantástico. Y aparte dice, cuando usted vuelva a China y llega el primer día a la oficina con este abrigo, sus compañeros va a decir, wow, se va a quedar muy sorprendidos y les va a dar mucha envidia. Entonces, este mienzi le está dando mienzi al cliente. Otro detalle, por ejemplo, he estado acompañando, por ejemplo, unos oficiales del gobierno chino aquí haciendo un poco de compra después de su visita. Estamos en una tienda de jamón. Entonces, quiere comprar una paleta entera y el problema es que no le cabía en la maleta. Entonces dice al chico de la tienda que le atendía, el chico todo muy amable, muy polite y todo, y el señor chino le dice, ¿usted me podría cortarlo a la mitad? Y así ya lo puedo meter en la maleta. Entonces al chico que le atendía en la tienda de jamón ibérico le dolió el corazón y le dice, ¿cómo se puede cortar una paleta a la mitad? O sea, en ese momento estaba el señor chino, estaba yo, que es el jefe, el señor chino, estaba sus colegas al lado, los que trabajan con él. Entonces se sentía muy, que ha perdido mucho miento, ¿no? Como diciendo que el jefe no tiene idea sobre cómo se come un jamón. Entonces, de esto se tiene que intentar evitar dar este tipo de comentarios o evitar este tipo de situaciones. Y luego tenemos la famosa palabra de guanxi. Siempre digo que la palabra más importante en chino no es gracias, no es hola, ni hao. Es guanxi. Guanxi es una mezcla, o sea, la traducción literal es relaciones interpersonales, pero es una mezcla de mucho más connotaciones que esto. Tiene que ver con el social status, el estatus social. Tiene que ver con favorecimiento mutuo, tiene que ver con enchufe en cierto sentido, tiene que ver con también el lado afectivo, que me has caído bien y hay cierto sentido de amistad. Pero entonces es una combinación del lado afectivo y el lado práctico de interés. Esto es el guanxi. Entonces el guanxi es muy importante tanto en relaciones comerciales a largo plazo como en un, por ejemplo, tratamiento a un turista chino en una tienda, que puede ser una cuestión de 20 minutos, pero si se logra construir un guanxi, un feeling, dentro de este poco tiempo puede favorecer bastante a la atención. La tercera palabra es Tengji, Tengji, que es literalmente jerarquía. Es una cultura altamente jerárquica, lo cual quiere decir que aquí el jefe es importante. En China es muy, muy importante. Quiere decir, si no se cuida este Tengji, puede llegar, o sea, identificar en la primera instancia quién es la persona más importante y quién es la persona que toma decisiones que en algunos casos no necesariamente corresponde a la persona con mayor cargo. Es muy importante en este caso. Y el Tengji se refleja, como ha mencionado el doctor Latham, en formalismo, lo cual quiere decir que el Tengji es una cosa que se tiene que demostrar por su parte y se tiene que reconocer por nuestra parte, de darle mienzi por su nivel, o sea, mienzi en cierto sentido en ese caso puede ser piropos, en culturas latinas funcionaría muy bien y reconocer su Tengji como usted es el que decide, usted lo que diga usted les lo haremos. Otra palabra es Renqing. Como ha mencionado Dr. Latham, es una cultura mucho más colectivista y menos individualista. Entonces, una persona como individuo se disuelve en un montón de relaciones sociales. Quiere decir, una persona no existe. Yo en China no existiría como Cao Yuan. Existiría como hija de alguien, madre de alguien, colega de alguien, jefa de alguien, o soy un conjunto de relaciones sociales. Por lo tanto, muchas cosas que hago, por ejemplo, un viaje a Europa, un viaje a los Estados Unidos, no es solamente por mí, sino por mis relaciones. Y en esto se refleja en actos, por ejemplo, de llevar regalos, de constantemente comunicar con ellos sobre mis viajes, enviarles fotos, comentarles que esto me ha gustado, el otro me ha parecido fatal. Este tipo de comunicación es muy importante. O sea, cuando una cosa la hago, no solamente la hago por mí, sino la hago por todas mis relaciones y contactos sociales. Otro concepto es xinyong. Xinyong literalmente quiere decir trust, confianza. Pero no es el trust que entendemos en el ámbito occidental. Porque normalmente una persona se merece la confianza cuando hace las cosas justas. Justo para mí, justo para ti. Y en chino, algo es justo o es injusto suena incluso muy traducido, suena importado. O sea, lo que se dice en chino es adecuado. Hacer esto es adecuado o no. Y una persona que, o sea, no hay un correcto e incorrecto absoluto, sino que todo depende de cómo lo haces, con quién lo haces, cuándo lo haces, todo es relativo. Entonces una persona tiene xinyong, es una persona que conoce, que analiza bien la situación y sabe siempre claramente qué se puede hacer, de qué manera, con quién y cuándo. ¿De acuerdo? Entonces, estas son las, por ejemplo, los puntos que ya hemos mencionado y que luego vamos a completar con más detalles. Otro punto a mencionar es una cultura que percibe mucho más que razona. Lo cual quiere decir que cuando, tanto en tratamientos comerciales como en turísticos, muchas veces cuando quiere algo y le ha dicho que esto es imposible, lo sentimos mucho, puede volver a preguntar. Porque lo que percibe incluso es el mensaje, no es el mensaje literal de la palabra no, o un no directo o indirecto, sino la actitud. O sea, se puede sentir angustiado por la actitud y no por el mensaje, el hecho de que no lo hay. Por lo tanto, es muy importante decir lo que ha mencionado Dr. Latham, que no decir un no directo, para que perciba la afinidad, que perciba la amabilidad, la cercanía cultural, que realmente nosotros estamos pensando por ustedes, pero lamentablemente no lo tenemos. y más que razonamiento, ¿no? Y otro punto es, hay un concepto borroso sobre las instrucciones. Cuando viajaba por Suiza y leía a la ventana, el vidrio de la ventana, que sobre la cuestión está escrito, sobre la cuestión de abrir o cerrar la ventana, la persona que está sentada al lado de la ventana tiene prioridad. Esto en el concepto chino es impensable. Muchas fábricas, por ejemplo aquí, por ejemplo de galleta, cuando en su almacén tiene que diferenciar diferentes tipos de galleta, utilizan el mismo tipo de cajas y poniendo la etiqueta, ¿no?, con el nombre de la galleta respectivo. Pero en China, en muchas fábricas tienen que utilizar diferentes colores de cajas. Caja azul para tal galleta, caja amarilla para otras. Entonces, en general, no existe una cultura de leer en toda parte las instrucciones. Por ejemplo, si quiero saber cómo llegar a tal sitio, no leo el nombre de la calle y miro el mapa, sino paro a alguien en la calle y le pregunto. ¿Sí? Entonces, el tratamiento, en este caso, también hay que tener un poco más de paciencia si alguien está... Entiendo que, por ejemplo, los dependientes en la tienda son muy ocupados en todo el día, y si pregunto algo muy obvio que está ahí puesto, y sobre todo si está puesto en inglés, que es de talla 36 a 38, solo aquí, y no lo lee. Y mucho peor en inglés, porque también ahí hay una cuestión lingüística, que si habéis aprendido una lengua que no está escrito en letras romanas, se entiende, porque en un texto, aunque pueda leer perfectamente en castellano, pero si hay una hoja totalmente en castellano en inglés, con una sola palabra en chino, leo la palabra en chino. O sea, lo mismo pasa seguramente con ustedes en otra lengua, que no con letras. Entonces, hay que entender la dificultad de reconocer, y sobre todo instrucciones que no esté en chino. Por lo tanto, instrucciones, es importante que esté en chino, es importante que esté claro, con pocas palabras, es importante que esté colocado en un lugar visualmente fácil, y es importante que se repita muchas veces. Por ejemplo, hay hoteles que no lavan las toallas todos los días. Entonces dice, si usted quiere que le cambien las toallas, tírelas al suelo, ¿no? Y la gente no lo hace. Aunque el letrero en la mesita de noche esté en chino y lo lee, pero lo lee y no lo hace. O sea, simplemente no. Y luego deja la toalla colgada y luego no le han cambiado, y se queja de que no le han cambiado la toalla, o simplemente dice que este hotel no tiene un servicio le falta consideración. Pero muchas veces hay que repetir instrucciones. Vale, primera parte, vamos a hablar un poco de protocolo, que creo que ya la mayoría de los puntos ya ha sido cubiertos. Y la segunda parte vamos a hablar de prácticas comerciales concretas en tratamiento tanto a los turistas chinos como a los clientes, en los casos de retail y en casos comerciales. Y en la tercera parte vamos a especificar un poco más en Internet, que es un fenómeno realmente en China en los últimos años. Y esta parte de Internet tenemos tres subdivisiones, tres partes. La primera es ¿Cómo se informan? O sea, ¿cómo hacer llegar la información a los clientes o turistas chinos? La segunda parte es cómo hacer la venta online, sobre todo para el sector del retail. La tercera parte es cómo construir la marca a través del Internet. Bueno, ya sabemos que autopresentación, sobre todo cuando identificamos... En estas fotos es fácil saber quién es el jefe. Es típico que el jefe esté colocado en el centro. Y cuando hacemos la presentación es muy importante saludar primero al jefe, dar la mano primero a la persona más importante y luego a sus colegas. Las palabras gracias, por favor, adiós, no siempre se dice por su parte. Pero cuando atendemos al cliente, por nuestra parte es importante. ¿no? Pero de su parte no siempre se dice. Nombre y apellido en las tarjetas chinas, en la costumbre china es colocar primero el apellido y luego el nombre por ser una cultura familista. Quiere decir que se interesa sobre todo saber de qué familia eres y luego quién eres en la familia. Pero también hay chinos occidentalizados, como en este caso he puesto primero el nombre, ¿no? Yuan, y luego el apellido Cao. ¿Cuál es el truco? Si ves normalmente dos sílabas, si ves una sola sílaba, puede ser nombre o apellido. Pero si ves dos sílabas, por ejemplo, Zhiping, ¿sí? Z-H-I-P-I-N-G, seguro que es un nombre. ¿De acuerdo? Y si no, preguntamos cuál es su apellido, que no es una ofensa, pero es importante. Y otra cosa a mencionar, es importante tratar a una persona con su apellido más su cargo. O sea, Wang, doctor. Wang, médico. Wang, gerente. Wang, xianshen. O si no, simplemente señor Wang. Wang, xianshen. Wang, señor. Y no llamar el nombre completo, al menos que estés muy seguro que el estilo de esta persona es bastante juvenil y occidentalizado, o que estés seguro de que estáis en un nivel bastante de par en par. Y solo el nombre no se llama. Si solo llamar a una persona Zhiping, quiere decir que es una familia muy cercana o es de pareja. Entonces, solo nombre no se llama. Otra cuestión, diferencias lingüísticas que ya hemos visto que en China hay más de 136 lenguas oficialmente reconocidas, mucho más dialectos que técnicamente son lenguas, pero por consideraciones políticas se consideran dialectos y que son totalmente ininteligibles entre ellas. Entonces, entre estas lenguas, no esperemos de que todos los chinos nos vienen, aunque la mayoría absoluta de los chinos que han llegado aquí hablan muy bien el chino mandarín, pero siempre con el acento, puede ser acento muy marcado. Por lo tanto, si alguna persona que ha aprendido 4 años chino aquí puede no entender fácilmente a una persona china. Que incluso nosotros, que cuando llamo a la zona de Cantón, que la lengua es cantonesa, y cuando hablan mandarín, hablan en gramática cantonesa y traduciendo el vocabulario al chino mandarín, por lo tanto, tendría yo por teléfono, tendría que repetir cada frase para asegurar que he entendido bien. Por lo tanto, la lengua es un tema importante. Por lo tanto, siempre es aconsejable, yo pienso, tener a alguien nativo por la cercanía lingüística y por la cercanía cultural. Y hay empresas que pueden decir que nosotros es que no podemos, o sea, contratar a alguien nativo nos supone un coste muy alto. Entonces hay diferentes fórmulas, por ejemplo, becarios, etcétera, etcétera. Pero es importante, es diferente. Pero la lengua, entonces la gente piensa que ya tengo solucionado la lengua, tengo todo en chino, ya tengo solucionado el problema. Y no es así. No es así. Muchas veces no es por la falta de la palabra en chino, sino por falta de concepto. Por ejemplo, muchos restaurantes tienen su menú perfectamente, su carta perfectamente traducido al chino. Y tengo amigos que viajan por aquí y dice, Joan, ¿qué quiere decir jamón ibérico y pilia huotui y jamón serrano serrano huotui? Que son palabras existentes en chino. Y no saben la diferencia y no saben por qué uno cuesta 8 euros y el otro 22 euros. ¿No? Entonces son conceptos que no existen en China. Entonces, más que una traducción literal, hay que hacer una traducción cultural. Por ejemplo, imaginamos, a mí me gusta hacer un espejismo, ¿de acuerdo? Si queremos acercar nuestro negocio a turistas chinos, yo siempre pongo el ejemplo de que piense usted una empresa china de sojas, que en China hay más de 300 tipos de sojas. Soja añeja, soja fresca, que es totalmente desconocido aquí en Europa. Entonces, si usted quiere introducir una marca de soja que tiene 150 años de historia, que aquí es totalmente desconocido, sobre su uso, sobre las características del producto, sobre la historia de la marca, la cultura, la filosofía que hay atrás, ¿qué haría usted? Seguramente no puede traducir la etiqueta que pegada al producto al castellano y ya está, ¿no? Entonces hay un trabajo de fondo mucho más atrás, y para eso tendríamos que saber primero cuáles son las informaciones ya instaladas en el imaginario del cliente chino y cuáles queda como vacío. Por ejemplo, aquí tenemos un ejemplo. Si esta empresa quiere promocionar sus productos, ¿les parecería bien traducirlo al chino? ¿Les parecerían bien las fotos, las mismas fotos? Porque realmente un trozo de jamón pasando un cuchillo por encima o una oliva goteando aceite, para un chino no quiere decir mucho mensaje como para una persona de aquí. O sea, no conoce la diferencia de diferentes especies de oliva, diferentes sabores, diferente uso, no sabe a qué plato se echa. Incluso no sabe qué sabor es el sabor que debe tener. O sea, no tiene herramientas, no tiene información como herramientas. Entonces, primero, el cliente necesita ver el producto final. O sea, una oliva goteando con una gota de aceite realmente no tiene mucha información. Tiene que ver la botella, o sea, si decide comprarlo como producto de regalo a su jefe en China después de su viaje, o al simplemente al profesor de piano de su hijo. O sea, en muchas ocasiones en China que son necesarios para hacer un regalo, mientras aquí no, ¿sí? Y necesita ver cómo sería el frasquito al final que debo comprar, cómo queda, si el diseño queda muy elegante o se ve muy de supermercado. Necesita ver el producto final y necesita una información adicional, ¿sí? Por eso muchas veces vemos una pequeña etiqueta que parece un librito colgado en la botella con la información, con la historia, la filosofía de la marca. Este tipo de información adicional podría ayudar mucho. Otro punto importante en el trato personal a los clientes, ha mencionado el doctor Latham que ayuda mucho unas palabras en chino. Entonces, ¿dónde podemos encontrar estas palabras? En YouTube hay muchos canales, por ejemplo, Active Chinese, que nos enseña en pocos clips, de pocos minutos, nos enseña las tres frases básicas en chino. Incluso hay clips, hay vídeos especificados para tratamiento de hostelería, tratamiento de restaurantes, colores, si atendemos en una tienda de ropa, que nos encanta. O sea, a los clientes chinos les encantaría mucho que esté más bien, más que la información en chino, que también entendería en inglés, es la actitud, es demostrar el interés por su cultura y su lengua. Y otra forma es preguntarle in situ al cliente chino cómo se dice. Por ejemplo, he visto una empresa de aquí que va a China a visitar a su cliente para especificar, yo quiero 20.000 piezas de este producto, ¿de acuerdo? Pero en vez de este color de tapón, yo quiero en rojo. ¿Usted me puede decir cómo se dice rojo en chino? Hongse. Ah, muy bien, pero yo quiero esto, pero el tapón en hongse. Entonces, le queda muy bien la información, le queda muy clara, y también es una demostración de interés. Es una cultura de regalo. O sea, tanto como usted hace una visita comercial o recibe una visita comercial, como los turistas chinos que vienen aquí, el regalo es un tema importante. Por ejemplo, aquí podemos ver que son es un producto de aceite de oliva. Aquí, para hacer un producto de alto standing, ya lo ha convertido en botellas revestidas, en un color muy, muy, muy elegante. Pero después el distribuidor en China, al recibir este producto, le ha añadido la caja. O sea, esta caja lo ha hecho el distribuidor en China, porque piensa que solo con la botella no es suficiente para que sea un producto de alto nivel, alta gama, sino que para que sea un regalo de verdad hay que añadirle algo más. Entonces, muchas veces el packaging incluso es más importante que el contenido en sí, porque el regalo, cuando se hace en China, no es solamente una demostración de que me caes bien, y son la amistad, la familia, sino tiene cierta función social. ¿De acuerdo? Entonces, el packaging está directamente relacionado con el mienzi, con la cara, con el estatus social y con el valor que se da, ¿no? El valor añadido de este regalo en sí como un objeto para utilizar. El regalo es se da recíprocamente. Quiere decir que precisamente por esta función social no puede ser que tu cliente lleva tres veces seguidas regalo a su empresa, sino que el regalo tiene que ser un acto mutuo para que sea continuo la relación comercial. Bueno, sobre ropa, el vestido en China no es un tema importante, pero no, comparado con Europa, no existe tanta formalidad. Quiere decir que la diferenciación de ropa para cada ocasión no es tan estricta, pero sí que hay ciertos criterios que sería mejor mantenerlos en cuenta. Por ejemplo, recordamos que en China es una sociedad que lleva 30 años de una época bastante sosiega y lleva 2000 años del confucianismo, lo cual destaca la colectividad y mata un poco la individualidad o el ¿cómo se llama? El individualismo, la personalidad. Entonces, escotes muy bajos, colores muy llamativos de la ropa, o adornos muy exagerados, o un color un poco no tan convencional en China. También tener en cuenta que en China todo el mundo tiene el mismo color de cabello, todo el mismo color de ojos, o sea, no un color demasiado raro de cabello o de corbata. No ayuda tanto, puede no afectar o afectar dependiendo del perfil de la contraparte china, pero definitivamente no ayuda. Entonces, muchas veces causa una impresión de que es una persona que a lo mejor no un poco impredecible, un poco salido del marco social, la norma social, ¿no? Entonces, intentar evitar esto. Por otra parte, tampoco medir, o sea, todos tenemos, ya estamos evaluando una persona a la primera vista. Tampoco evaluar una persona totalmente dependiendo de su apariencia, de su presentación. Hemos tenido una vez una experiencia de llegar a una ciudad de tercera línea, al aeropuerto, a visitar una fábrica. Entonces viene un chico joven con t-shirt y con unos pantalones cortos, que era verano, hacía mucho calor, un t-shirt de bastante relajado, ¿no?, de vacaciones. Entonces, hola, ¿cómo está, señor conductor? Y nos ha llevado a la fábrica, nos damos cuenta que era el vicepresidente de la fábrica. Entonces, tampoco, muchas veces, sobre todo dependiendo del perfil del turista chino, la persona que llega aquí, puede ser muy occidentalizado, puede haber vivido y estudiado afuera, puede ser el más fashion victim que lo que nos imaginamos, o también puede ser totalmente a la vieja escuela roja. Entonces, no intentar, es como que esta persona mira que cómo está vestido, seguramente no va a comprar en esta tienda, no tomar nada, por supuesto. Es una cultura que utiliza bastante el lenguaje no verbal. De hecho, cuando muchas veces encontramos, ¿no?, que les explicamos a unos turistas la diferencia de los productos, que esta es la nueva colección, después de 5 minutos de explicación dicen y no hay más comentarios. Eso no quiere decir, no es sinónimo de indiferencia. A lo mejor está procesando la información, está pensando o está pensando otra cosa. Está pensando, está comparando este abrigo con otro que ha visto ayer, o está pensando, este no me gusta, pero a lo mejor para fulanito se lo puedo regalar. Pero toda esta información no lo da, ni mucho menos en una lengua que no es la suya. ¿Sí? No hay la costumbre de hablar en voz alta. Entonces, lo que se percibe muchas veces es un silencio. ¿Sí? En este caso, ¿qué hacemos? Hay que reconocer que hay cierto desconocimiento de algunos productos aquí. Por ejemplo, si compro o no compro el aceite, o si compro o no compro tal producto de lujo. O este estilo de reloj es para tal ocasión. Entonces, es bueno pasar un poco la línea. O sea, la línea de la decisión es personal, es de usted. Se puede pasar un poco la línea de decirle, mire, si usted necesita para tal ocasión, este. ¿Sí? Se puede pasar un poco. La sonrisa. La sonrisa es sobre todo un plus, porque es inconsciente. Tampoco es siempre que para mostrar que está muy contento, demasiada amabilidad o incluso en ocasiones muy formales, una reunión comercial muy formal, la sonrisa puede incomodar a la gente de aquí, que he dicho algo equivocado, se está riendo de mí. Pero la sonrisa es simplemente una costumbre. O sea, cuando una persona oriental habla, muchas veces sonríe. ¿Sí? Y si recibe el mismo tratamiento, el mismo código no verbal, le ayuda a construir la cercanía, la afinidad. Pero si no sonreímos, tampoco importa, porque sé que esto es muy difícil de controlar, tanto la sonrisa como contacto corporal, contacto visual. O sea, se puede formando la conciencia, pero es difícil, porque una vez fui a una empresa a contarles esto de la sonrisa y me dicen, la semana pasada han venido un experto en Rusia y nos ha dicho que a los clientes rusos no se puede sonreír porque eso significa falta de profesionalidad. Entonces no puedes estar pensando, si es un chino sonrío, si es un ruso no sonrío. Es incontrolable, pero intentar acercar sí que se puede hacer. Por ejemplo, el contacto corporal. Muchas veces cuando voy a una tienda y muy amable la dependiente y me coge el brazo y me dice, mira esto, con los clientes chinos, sobre todo los que vienen de China, intentar evitar contactos corporales puede incomodar bastante, y precisamente en las culturas latinas son muy de contactos corporales, ¿no? Contacto visual. En el primer dibujo, lo que llamamos aquí mirada directa, contacto visual directa, y si pongo las mismas palabras, contacto visual directa, en chino y en Google me sale el segundo dibujo, lo cual se considera una mirada un poco suave, no tan lanzada, o incluso una mirada intermitente, que es lo que más se ve en la foto de abajo en culturas anglosajonas o en países nórdicos. Lo normal en culturas asiáticas es una mirada indirecta. Quiere decir que si... ¿Cómo les parece si les estoy hablando, pero miro a la pantalla, miro los papeles que tengo delante y muy poco tiempo estoy mirando a mi contraparte? ¿Sí? Esto es normal. Si un cliente les está hablando de que casi prefiere el otro reloj, pero mirando otros relojes en la vitrina, es normal, no es una falta de interés. Comida, como hemos mencionado, no existe. O sea, entre una distancia de Marruecos a Moscú no existe una sola comida china. Entonces, la comida en el sur de Cantón, Fujian, puede ser más dulce, Hunan, Sichuan son tremendamente picantes, en Beijing y el norte el sabor es más salado. Entonces, la cuestión es, cuando una persona china viene aquí, ¿prefiere la comida de aquí? ¿Prefiere aprovechar el viaje para probar algo típico o prefiere la comida china. Realmente yo he encontrado todo tipo de respuestas. Depende del perfil del turista, depende de su edad, depende de su experiencia china, porque a mí me ha sorprendido mucho que los hijos de mis compañeros de colegio, por ejemplo, que ya ahora tienen 5 o 6 años, utilizan los cubiertos perfectamente, igual que un niño de aquí. Y están muy acostumbrados a comer pasta, espagueti, sticks, filetes, realmente comer pan. Realmente no les sorprende un sabor chino ni un sabor occidental. O sea, para ellos hay pocos sabores desconocidos. Pero si es una persona mayor, digamos que 50 años, 60, 70, 80 años, probablemente prefiere la comida china. Hay gente, incluso gente joven, que llega a cada ciudad europea y pregunta, ¿cuál es el mejor restaurante chino de aquí? Entonces, tener esta información también nos ayuda mucho. Pero cuando recibo un grupo, siempre les pregunto a la persona encargada del grupo. Cuando lleguen a Barcelona, ¿prefieren comida china o prefieren algo muy típico aquí? ¿No? Que también hay muy buenas opciones. Y me dicen una cosa u otra. Entonces, siempre es mejor consultar. Después puede cambiar la idea, porque en China piensan, ay, Barcelona, qué bien, vamos a probar algo típico, vamos a probar jamón, tapas, y después de una semana y media en Europa ya están cansados de sabores desconocidos. Y llegar aquí me dicen, con una cara desesperada, dicen, no, vamos a un chino. Entonces, siempre es mejor preguntar y tener un plan B. ¿Sí? Como ya sabemos que la manera de comer es, como podemos ver en la foto, es una mesa redonda con un aparato que gira, entonces cada uno va picando los platos que pasa por delante y que eligiendo lo que más le guste, ¿no? Entonces, para una persona de aquí, si es las primeras veces que come de esta forma, puede ser un poco peligroso porque al no tener la porción delante no sabe la cantidad real que ha comido. Primero son los platos fríos. Luego vienen los platos calientes, luego viene la sopa. Pero antes de la sopa y el arroz o comida de harina, puede venir un pescado, lo cual indica el inicio del final. Y después no suele haber postre. ¿Sí? La fruta es normal, pero postre no mucho, porque en China no es apagar el sabor salado con un sabor dulce y apagar el sabor dulce con el sabor de café, sino suavizar el sabor que hemos comido con un té. ¿Sí? Entonces, las costumbres de comida es muy diferente y luego vamos a saltar un poco esta parte y vamos directamente a aquí. Entonces, como hostelería, ¿qué es lo que debemos ofrecer en el sentido de comida? Yo creo que en el caso de comida y cena es relativamente fácil, porque aquí tenemos, si están interesados pueden buscar Yang Liu Design, que es una diseñadora chino-alemana que ha hecho muchos diseños sobre la diferencia cultural. Es muy interesante. Aquí en azul dice que en Alemania se come frío, caliente, frío. En China se come caliente, caliente, caliente. Por lo tanto, yo también creo que el desayuno es la parte más difícil de acostumbrarse, tanto como la gente de aquí cuando va a China, como la gente china cuando vienen aquí. Entonces, tener unas opciones de la comida china, así sea sencilla, de las opciones más fácil de elaborar, que usted como un hotel no tiene que reservar en un restaurante chino, sino que, por ejemplo, el huevo estrellado o una sopa de arroz, que son fáciles de hacer, es muy importante, porque he visto hoteles que ofrece un buffet de desayuno espectacular, pero todo occidental. Entonces llega el cliente chino, no encuentra nada similar a lo que suele comer en desayuno, entonces comenta a sus compañeros que este hotel no tiene mayor cosa. Entonces, como ya sabemos que esto de redes sociales es un fenómeno que da miedo en China, enseguida pasa las fotos tanto hace una publicidad tanto para bien como para mal, ¿no? Y como hotel también es importante un hervidor de agua, como muchos hoteles en Alemania, en Suiza. Y el té de Lipton, normalmente, al tener cliente chino le ofrecemos té. El té Lipton en China no es té, es como el café instantáneo de Nescafé, no es café para la gente de Europa. Hay gente que viaja con su propio té y hay otra gente que casi prefiere si es un té de bolsita, pero de una marca, té verde sobre todo, de una calidad un poco mayor. Ya sabemos que los servicios del hotel en China suelen ser bastante rápidos, desde la tintorería, la lavada en seco, que suele estar listo en unas horas. Por lo tanto, y además el turista chino tiene pocos días en cada ciudad. Entonces, cuando llega aquí, ya manda a sus camisas a lavar y lo tiene que sacar mañana a las 8 de la noche, entonces ya le sorprende un poco, ¿no? Y también el check-in, check-out suele ser bastante rápido. Muchas veces pide una habitación que está a la calle, a pesar del ruido y todo, porque cuando viaja a un país totalmente diferente, le parece un valor añadido poder apreciar una vista que da a la ciudad. Y estos utensilios de aseo, de zapatillas y pijama, es algo básico incluso en un hotel en China en 3 estrellas. Y no suele viajar con estas cosas. Entonces, al llegar a un hotel de 4 estrellas y no encuentra zapatillas, puede decir otra vez, uy, este no tiene muy buen servicio. Vamos un poco. Estos son son ejemplos, por ejemplo, de compra de lujo. Compra de lujo, que es una fiebre. El turista chino suele buscar exclusividad. En realidad, esto de por ejemplo, en Toulouse, el gobierno de Toulouse ha organizado, ha diseñado una ruta especial de bodegas para bodas a los chinos. Y la información directamente se dirige a los jóvenes en China, y a los jóvenes, no a los jóvenes una vez ya llegando aquí, ¿no? Entonces, esto ya estamos hablando a un nivel de diseño un poco más superior que un hotel o una bodega, pero es totalmente necesario. No sé cuánto de nosotros nos gustaría tener una cena con este taller de Airbus como fondo. Allí también ha organizado como algo exclusivo. Usted puede tener una cena en el taller con un avión de Airbus como fondo, ¿no? Entonces, realmente la persona que ha diseñado este proyecto tiene que conocer bastante el gusto chino y salir del punto de vista europeo, ¿no? Busca convenience. El aeropuerto de París ha diseñado una aplicación para los turistas chinos al llegar, nada más llegando. Entonces ya tiene, a través de esta aplicación, toda la información desde mapa, vuelos, compra, ofertas en chino. Y le indica como Google Map cómo llegar a la tienda que desea. Esta es una página muy importante, como ha mencionado, ha recalcado el doctor Latham. La combinación de visado y aerolínea es fundamental, aunque es algo que está fuera de nuestras manos como pymes. Es un diseño más bien gubernamental del país, forma parte de la estrategia de la política turística. Porque cuando una persona china quiere viajar por los países Schengen, lo primero que piensa es, ¿por qué país entro? O sea, aparte de la ubicación geográfica, piensa, ¿en qué país me ofrece el procedimiento de visado más fácil? Que yo no tengo que desplazar de mi ciudad que queda tranquilamente a 800 kilómetros de Shanghai. No tengo que tomar un tren de 5 horas para ir al consulado de este país en Shanghai. Y no me pide 13 documentos diferentes, no me pide traducir proveer mi estatus de banco y traducirlo al inglés o al francés y llevarlo al consulado. Entonces es fundamental los visados. Últimamente hay una ola de relajar los requisitos de visado, sobre todo los cuatro países, Italia, Alemania, Francia y Austria, han levantado una cierta competencia entre estos cuatro países, pero aquí todavía. O sea, pongo mi ejemplo, que mi familia vive en China, tengo un tío que vive en Alemania. Entonces mis padres, cuando vienen a visitarme, no solicitan el visado de España, solicitan el visado de Alemania, porque no tienen que ir a Shanghai, sino a través de una agencia. Pero vuelan aquí. Entonces, por lo tanto, compra el billete de Lufthansa y no de Air France, porque el primer punto de entrada a la Unión Europea es Frankfurt o Düsseldorf. Entonces, pensamos que en vez de mis padres, pensamos un grupo de turistas. Si entran en Europa en Frankfurt y salen en Frankfurt, y para comprar Louis Vuitton, que lo pueden hacer en Frankfurt, en Barcelona o en París o en Roma, lo harían en Frankfurt, que es lógico la última parada para no pasear toda la compra por Europa. Y por otro lado, para la devolución de impuestos, que es un tema muy importante para todos los turistas chinos, es más fácil comprar en Frankfurt y hacerlo en la misma tienda o en el mismo aeropuerto de Frankfurt y no comprar aquí en Corte Inglés y luego bajar al sótano de Corte Inglés y hacer el ticket y ir a Frankfurt y hacer la fila otra vez. Entonces, esto determina, o sea, la combinación de aerolínea y visado determina fundamentalmente el acto de consumo, que es un punto muy importante. Otro punto importante es el China Union Pay, que es como Mastercard o Visa, pero chino. O sea, luego vamos a encontrar en muchos aspectos, por ejemplo, en el convenio de permiso de conducir, el chino es otro sistema. En redes sociales, las redes sociales chinas es otro sistema. Entonces China es como un pequeño planeta que tiene todo, pero tiene todo desconectado con el sistema mundial, el resto del mundo. Entonces, ¿qué hacemos? Aquí dice, aceptamos China Union Pay. En el McDonald's del aeropuerto Charles de Gaulle ponen un letrero en chino, aceptamos moneda china. Entonces, o sea, es un pequeño esfuerzo que al menos se puede hacer, ¿no?, de cada negocio. Enseñar el uso del producto, como hemos mencionado. Enseñar cómo se come este producto, ¿no? Cómo se utiliza este producto. Diseñar algo diferente. Por ejemplo, al ofrecer... Hay turistas muy sofisticados chinos, que una persona que le ves y es como una persona normal en la calle, y luego me cuenta que ha viajado por 66 países, entonces ya no hay nada que presentarle. Pero también personas que llega a un estatus bastante alto, el presidente de una empresa estatal, nacional, pero que cuando se le ofrece, es un caso real, cuando se le ofrece este café, coge la cucharita y empieza a beber el café con la cucharita. Y entonces realmente, o sea, las costumbres son tan diferentes en cada detalle diario y el perfil es, hay tanta disparidad en el perfil de turista que realmente hay que entrar un poco en las matices. Otro tema, aprovecho un poco para decir esto de storytelling, sobre todo para pymes aquí. Este desconocimiento del fondo cultural, histórico, filosófico europeo, también es algo que se puede aprovechar, porque esto de storytelling, de montar la historia desde el Imperio Romano, Romaster, para explicar un producto de Europa, o la casa, o los fundadores de esta bodega, cómo se enamoraron y cómo casaron y fundaron esta bodega. Todo esto para una persona europea puede ser demasiado. O sea, lo que me interesa es el vino. Pero para una persona asiática es un valor añadido bastante importante, o a la hora de faltar conocimiento sobre el producto en sí, es precisamente la pista para que atraerle a entrar la puerta. Entonces hay que utilizar este storytelling, hay que utilizar este romanticismo, hay que utilizar las marcas que no son tuyas, pero que también son marcas incluso con mayor valor añadido que la nuestra. Por ejemplo, Europa, diseñado en Barcelona, Mediterranean Way of Life, que son marcas públicas, digamos, y muchas veces por falta de esta marca que ya está implantada en el imaginario del consumidor, sufrimos por el desconocimiento. Unos expertos en importación de alimentación una vez me ha comentado, pero esta semana nos ha invitado a una cata de vinos de Castilla-La Mancha. Yo sí, pues muy bien. Ah, entonces son vinos españoles, sí. La semana pasada eran vinos aragoneses, también son españoles, sí. Entonces la próxima semana tenemos otra comunidad, entonces no tiene un imaginario, ¿no? No le falta una marca como concepto compartido, y además es una marca que mientras más se utiliza no se desgasta, sino se hace más fuerte, ¿no? Entonces el internet, aprovechando, voy a pasar unos 5 minutos, vale, gracias. Aprovechando el internet, que como sabemos que en China en el próximo año 2015 va a tener el doble de usuarios de internet que Japón y los Estados Unidos juntos, y un 80% de ellos tiene acceso por móvil. Entonces la compra en China es sobre todo online y muchas veces por móvil, lo cual quiere decir que tener wifi disponible en nuestros locales es fundamental. No es solamente para decir, ay, tengo que pagar el wifi aparte, que es un coste para mí. Hay que pensar que este wifi es una inversión en publicidad directa, de la mejor forma. Entonces, yo tengo aquí en WeChat, que es el WhatsApp chino que ha mencionado Dr. Latham, yo tengo un grupo de 106 personas de compañeros de colegio. Anoche, en China ya ha amanecido, están hablando. Entonces, si voy con mi hijo a tal zoológico, alguien ha ido a tal zoológico en Singapur, y la otra chica dice, no, es fatal, pero en la noche es mejor. Otro dice, no, en la noche no me gusta. A mí me ha gustado más de día, y ha publicado más fotos. Entonces, hasta ahora, esta conversación sigue, ¿no? Es la mejor forma de promocionar por chinos, en chino y a chinos. Este QR lo tiene incluso el puestico de costurero debajo de mi casa en Nanjing, tiene un QR a la puerta de su local. Es una herramienta muy usual en chino. Hay plataformas como Tmall o Alibaba, este 360pay.com, que son plataformas equivalentes a Amazon, por ejemplo, y Alibaba, por ejemplo, ha creado un día de venta, un día de consumo simplemente, que es el 11 de noviembre, y en este día, a través de su plataforma principal, Tmall.com, ha vendido la facturación de Corte Inglés durante todo el año. Entonces, podemos pensar en Shanghai, que es una ciudad con 26 millones de habitantes. Si necesito a las 8 de la noche, necesito unos shampoos y otras cosas, galletas. Bajo, cojo el coche, 40 minutos en atasco, llego al mall o al Carrefour, aparco, subo, hago fila para pagar y 40 minutos de atasco para llegar a casa. Y para eso compro online, ¿no? Entonces, por ejemplo, Zara tiene su página propia y su página en la plataforma, que es casi igual, ¿no? Pero esta plataforma ayuda mucho, porque si alguien va ahí para buscar algo, le sale la información y no tiene que conocer la marca de Zara y conocer sus colecciones y ir a su página propia. Y aquí tenemos internet para la promoción de marcas Weibo, que son los Twitter chinos, Renren, que es el Facebook chino, y Youku Tudou, se ha fusionado, es el equivalente de YouTube chino. Entonces, aquí el Freshanet ha hecho una promoción online muy, muy famoso, muy, muy exitoso. Ha invitado, ha hecho una edición especial de 50 Magnum, ¿sí? Es llamado Golden Bubble, burbujas doradas. Ha invitado a gente de gourmet y del sector de fashion en China, regalándoles el Magnum, invitarles a decir su deseo para el año nuevo en la botella, publicar su foto en el Weibo, que es el Twitter chino, y ha sido tan tuiteados, y luego organizar una fiesta de Golden Bubbles invitando a estas celebridades. Y luego, ¿qué es lo que pasa? La prensa convencional les empieza a seguir el evento. O sea, automáticamente no tienes que contactar al periódico para publicar la noticia, sino que la noticia te busca. La Administración de Turismo de Nueva Zelanda quería publicar, porque es un país también poco conocido en China. Entonces, ¿cómo quiere promocionar el país como marca? Ha encontrado a esta señora, esta chica, que es una cantante, estrella de cine, y el blogger, la cuenta de Weibo más seguido en toda China. Aquí no se ve muy bien, tiene 36 millones, casi 35 millones de seguidores en el Weibo. Entonces le han detectado que esta chica se va a casar. Entonces le han invitado a casarse en Nueva Zelanda, con todo pagado, con todos sus invitados, etcétera, etcétera. Aún así es mucho más económico que hacer publicidades en revistas de avión, en televisión, etcétera, ¿no? Entonces ella ha ido y va publicando sus fotos, que está con su madre en un paisaje increíble. Ahí está la iglesia donde ella se ha casado, está en una finca con los animalitos, etcétera, etcétera. Entonces va publicando una experiencia, ¿no? Una experiencia tremendamente personal y con una influencia emotiva importante durante días. Y luego todas las prensa, periódicos y televisiones convencionales le empieza a perseguir a esta noticia originalmente online. Entonces es una promoción low cost, fantástico. Pero lo importante es que voy a publicitar mi hostal de cara a los clientes chinos. Entonces se tiene que hacer en chino y en las plataformas chinas, porque si no hay poca accesibilidad. Bueno, entonces creo que por el tiempo, lo siento, que cortamos aquí y muchas gracias.
Espero que hagi estat molt profitós per tots vostès. Tan sols recordar que al mes d'abril del proper any organitzarem la quarta edició del Congrés Internacional de Turisme Asiàtic i els esperem a tots. Res més, bon dia.